You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It's my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Heidi Tilney Kramer, who is a mom and an independent scholar focusing on critical children's studies and U.S. media. A former elementary school teacher, she teaches childhood in America at Eckerd College in Florida and lectures widely. Her new book is Media Monsters: Militarism, Violence, and Cruelty in Children's Culture. And I invited her on after reading a related article published at Open Democracy and at Alternet called How Movies Like Toy Story 3 and The Incredibles Are Turning Our Children into Violent, Militarized Monsters. Heidi Tilney Kramer, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David.
Thanks for coming on. It's a dramatic headline they had at Alternet, Militarized Monsters. What is wrong with these movies that are causing this?
Well, of course, you know, parents have been complaining about films for a long time, but coinciding with 9/11, they started including torture scenes, actual torture scenes, in American G and PG rated children's.
That's incredible to me. Do you have some examples?
I do. I wrote a thesis called Monsters Under the Bed, an analysis of torture scenes in three Pixar films. And those are Monsters Incorporated, The Incredibles, and Toy Story 3. But pretty much horrible action of putting such things in our children's films has gone beyond Pixar.
And this doesn't predate 9/11. This is a new phenomenon.
That's correct. You'll find torturous moments in children's films, but not the heavy militarism and torture scenes that, to my mind, started with Monsters Incorporated. And as a parent, I watched all of these films, and that one really struck me because there's little Boo, the toddler who is strapped into the scream extractor, which is made to look like an electric chair in that it has drainage holes in the seat. So there's a little toddler who speaks just a few words in the film strapped in, and I thought, I need to look at this much more.
Yeah. I don't know if you've studied this or if there's any way to study this, but I'm assuming that if children's films with torture scenes had come out of Hollywood in the 1990s, absent all the government endorsement of torture and torture in the news and the endless torture scenes in adult movies, there would have been some outrage from parents, right?
Well, one would think, you know, but we know that shows like 24 and Homeland came out to make the American public okay with torture. And they not only became okay with it, they became experts in it. So the fact that this is in children's films, when we have a problem with the school-to-prison pipeline, for example, you know, and endless wars now, is disturbing.
It's extremely disturbing. Other details you mention in your article, Disney trying to trademark the name SEAL Team 6, the name of a unit of the U.S. military. What is that about?
Yeah, exactly. And to use that on snow globes and, you know, Christmas presents seems in bad taste, to say the least.
And Disney has managed to do that, I take it.
Actually, I believe it was the Navy and public outcry which stopped them from doing that. They also tried to trademark the Day of the Dead, the sacred festival in Mexico, so they would coincide with the release of a film. But again, public outcry stopped that.
And it's not just torture, and it's not just war as a label in these films, right? It's extensive, horrific violence of all sorts, but without the sort of suffering and impact and criticism of violence that you have in at least a few more serious movies that depict violence, right? I mean, it's violence.
Well, that's right. It's very interesting the way that the torture is framed. So, for instance, in Monsters Incorporated, it's it all happens in an electric company, but it's like corporate and government tactics. The Incredibles, you know, which is a family ends up on the torture rack. Nothing happens to them, but they're on the same rack that the dad had been electrocuted on before. And then in Toy Story 3, after we've fallen in love with Buzz Lightyear over, you know, two films, he's tortured, his personality has changed, he's set back to his original mode. And then he becomes, he starts beating up his friends and becomes the jailer over them. So the other thing about this is that in Toy Story 3, the old man Chatter Telephone is shown bruised because he's been beaten for telling the gang how to escape. So we're seeing the results of torture. Also, in Monsters Incorporated, you see a character after interrogation wearing a neck brace with a number of bruises.
Yeah. Example just occurs to me as we're speaking of a torture scene that maybe predates 9/11, and that was a movie called The Princess Bride, which I'm not sure what it was rated, but I think in that movie torture was depicted as something horrible that the evil bad people do. It wasn't something that, you know, elicited actionable intelligence and was a good tool of good governance and so forth, but it was, you know, there probably are some examples like that of torture scenes, right?
Well, there probably are. And I know, I mean, I remember vividly watching Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the original one with Gene Wilder. And when they're in the boat going through a tunnel, there are a number of bizarre depictions, including, I believe, a chicken getting its head cut off, which doesn't really seem kid movie friendly either. So there are examples here and there throughout the entirety of children's films. I mean, including seeing a kid get beaten in one of the early Disney cartoons. But for it to have become common fare now, and nobody talking about how upsetting this is. I mean, in effect, we are training children to accept these policies that we have, you know.
And U.S. films are seen worldwide, right? Just as the example of the U.S. government is followed worldwide, these films normalize torture for people of all sorts, not just the 4% of people that you think are, you know, the good people who can use torture properly, right?
Well, and you know, on another interview that I had, somebody said, "But this is, you know, it's the good guys end up winning, so you know, it's not really presented like this is a good thing." I'm like, but it's presented. That's problematic that it's even there.
I agree. In your article, you sort of touch on the normalization of these sorts of violence across multiple media, not just movies. I mean, what are some parallels in the world of video games?
Right. So video games, of course, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman wrote Stop Teaching Our Kids to Kill some years back. And he's a psychology professor at West Point. a very, very good read.
He's also lately been training police to murder people in...
Interesting. I didn't know that update. that's the thing, right? This crossing of the military with the police is terrifying. But he does identify, if you will, the psychology behind this and how children become addicted to this behavior. So one of the examples that he gives is a 14-year-old Kentucky boy who had never fired a gun in real life, who played these video games and got a hold of a weapon, went to school, fired 8 times and had 8 hits, which I'm not a gun culture person, but apparently that's unheard of in gun culture. So they are effective training tools for killing, not to mention that your mindset gets hooked by it, and the language that goes with it, right? You're going to die, I'm going to kill you, whatever. So it's an onslaught of video games, what we think of as entertainment, quote-unquote, for children in their films. There are 5 media companies, as you know, which control over 90% of everything. And while this is going on, mind you, the JROTC is starting to move into middle school. So to train children for the military when they're 11 years old, most people don't know that. Most people don't know that there was an unpublicized provision in the No Child Left Behind Act, which expanded militarization in education. It's called Section 9528, the Armed Forces Recruiter Access to Students and Student Recruitment Information, which requires high schools to give all student contact information to the military. And parents can opt out by filling out a form, but most people don't even know that that's happening. So, and then, as you said, the films, PG-13 films in 2012 surpassed R-rated films in gun violence. You know, you're seeing, like, in the Minions movie, for instance, where they say, prepare for torture, and in the ads for it, that they're gleefully playing in a torture chamber.
And people can, by the way, go to studentprivacy.org if they want to get involved in campaigns to get their state to give parents an easy way to opt out of sending all their students' information to the military. This is something that Maryland has done, and in other states you have to find out all about this on your own, which, as you note, doesn't really happen. There's always been this debate, despite what seems like very strong evidence, over whether these films and video games have an impact. But doesn't the fact that the military invests in and collaborates and consults on producing so many movies and video games suggest that the military has a strong opinion on whether there's any impact or not?
Well, that's correct. And they will not, if a director asks the military for help because they need, like, an aircraft carrier or a helicopter for a scene, they have to give up, they have to give the Pentagon script approval. And if they don't like the script because it makes the military look bad in any way, they won't help, which is essentially censorship, right? Because that's paid for with tax dollars.
Yeah.
I've started a petition to John Lasseter on change.org called Pixar and Disney, No More Torture, Extreme Violence, and Militarism in GMPG Films, just to make them aware that we're aware of what's happening.
Yeah, it's badly needed. If you send me the link, we'll include that on the webpage with this show at talknationradio.org. The other thing, of course, that's going on, as you note in your article, is that the U.S. military is drone murdering children, killing children in wars, kicking in doors of households, torturing children. Do U.S. children know this? Do they find out about this?
Well, I'm sure they don't, because the mainstream press, of course, isn't covering the fact that we have tortured real children in the quest to fight terrorism. Like I said, the reason I'm doing this is because I was so appalled that nobody, you know, either scholars nor the reviewers of these films said, oh, wow, what's that doing in there? That just shows how militaristic I think our society has become and how easily led not just children but parents are. I mean, you know, I remember when my son was young, it was a challenge to find video games for early childhood. It's a challenge to, you know, I discovered Miyazaki films. Because several of those were benign as opposed to what we were offering our children here. Yeah. So
it seems like we've reached a point where scholars will tell you that nonviolent action works better than militarism and war and violence, and there's endless examples of nonviolently achieving social change and overthrowing tyranny and so forth. But has Disney ever made a movie about a nonviolent activist rather than a sword fighter or a gun shooter or a boxer? You know, I mean, aren't...
Well, exactly. Or geez, how about even, you know, an African-American doctor? You know, I mean, you look at these films really carefully. Like, everybody, there's a great article on Cracked.com. It's like the 10 most racist moments in Disney classic films.
Yeah.
And nobody's talking about what's happening now. It's still happening. You know, when, for instance, when Buzz Lightyear switched to Spanish mode in Toy Story 3, you know, he becomes, you know, he's dancing and he's singing and he's, you know, flirting with Jessie, who's kind of Woody's gal, you know, this Lothario kind of person. It's really racist to this day. And so when children see these films, they think, oh, a person who speaks like that must be like this. You know, every black person in these films, it's like there's this cool inner city vibe, like they might be drug dealers or something. It's not, as I said, a black doctor or a regular person. You know, in the film Turbo, it's two brothers that are from Mexico, and you see there's bars on the windows. At one point, he has to, driving in traffic, he has to stop at a light so that a police car with its siren on can fly by. You know, they make fun of when they're at the Indianapolis 500 in this film, the announcers make fun of T-shirts, you know, their homemade T-shirts. Like, you know, it's like amazing what you can do on a home computer these days. So they're very sexist, they're very racist, they're very classist. And I'm frustrated that nobody's really looking at that. We just mindlessly go, oh, we have to go out to the latest Pixar film, you know, with our kids, because that's the hip thing to do.
Yeah, and it's for kids, supposedly. What about Aladdin, which is set in a part of the world where numerous U.S. wars have been going on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they even, Henry Giroux talks about how that film was released during the first Gulf War. The lead characters, you know, the Princess Jasmine and Aladdin are drawn to be beautiful, if you will. Aladdin, he's taken, like, they used Tom Cruise, I guess, as a model for that character. But all of the other depictions of the Arabic world are insulting, that they're not drawn well. They didn't use real Arabic in the film. They used this nonsensical scrawl. They had the lines, I don't know if you remember, but where they'll cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home. And groups tried to get Disney to take that out. They finally did. But they do not have a good history of being kind to all types of people. And I think when you're in charge of training children, that should be a priority for you. So,
One would think so. We're speaking with Heidi Tilney Kramer, whose book is called Media Monsters, Militarism, Violence, and Cruelty in Children's Culture. Heidi, you also wrote about children in schools witnessing their classmates being arrested in school, and about the school to prison slash military pipeline. This is something that fits with this sort of culture.
Well, it does, and really, as I said, I was an elementary school teacher briefly. And I was a bit appalled by what I saw in the schools, but to know that there are examples like children, they have these slave auctions now, for instance, to teach children what slavery was like, or the coming over on the ship experience. Unfortunately, several teachers have used students of color as the slaves on the auction block, and had the white kids choose which were worthy enough for purchase, for instance. But children who are even getting behind in their homework, or, who write a loving message on their desk, are being, the police are being called. They're sent straight to the police station. There's no calling the parent first. These are infractions, minor infractions, that used to be, you'd have to go talk to the principal, but now, and they're replicating the prison system in poor neighborhoods and neighborhoods of color. You need to teach your child now what to do in case you're arrested, and it does, it all plays into, what they're portraying in media.
Yeah, I wonder what you think of campaigns that some are promoting to try to get the last nation on earth, namely this one, to sign on to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, of course forbids recruiting children to the military and forbids life prison sentences for children and forbids various things that go on in U.S. culture. Would it be
useful? Well, and I don't think. Yeah, no, it would be wonderful, and of course, never happen.
Why never happen?
Well, I think the main argument is that it might go against parental rights, which is hilarious. But in actuality, we couldn't do, we couldn't be starting to put, the ROTC into middle schools if we had that in place.
Well, I'm not putting the ROTC into middle schools, and plenty of people said ending slavery would never happen. Plenty of people said women voting would never happen. I mean, anything that's ever happened, everybody said it would never happen.
Well, I'm still hopeful, of course, because we are breaking a number of the articles of that agreement.
Yeah. What do you think of the bill that more and more people seem to think is a progressive proposal called the DREAM Act, which essentially, as I understand it, still says that if you are an immigrant young person without documented legal residency, you can go to college if you happen to win the lottery, or you can join the military, and that way you can be a citizen. It's not exactly my dream for this country or the world, but share my criticism, or do you think it's a...
I totally share your criticism, and I read something recently, and I can't remember where, but they were talking about putting in a similar thing in I believe in the Chicago school, that by the time you graduated from high school, you had to have, you either had to show proof that you were going to college or, as you said, going to the military. So.
Yeah, yeah, this was a Rahm Emanuel proposal in Chicago, one of the worst politicians I'm aware of, Rahm Emanuel, but who won't be there much longer, I think. But yeah, it's outrageous to
me. You know, and consider this, right? Like, the top three employers here, I believe, are the military, McDonald's, and Walmart. So as we're heading into the total service industry, you know, for our workforce and getting rid of real jobs, what choice will people really have? Particularly if you're not giving good resources to schools, so the children aren't being properly trained to go to college. They're being, you know, and of course now even if they do, they're going to get knee deep into debt probably from student loans. Another travesty. Mm-hmm. But we are making it so there are fewer and fewer options for our youth.
Yeah, and the one that actually pays far better than the other two of those three is of course the military. The people who come to my town here in Charlottesville, Virginia, with their racist signs, you know, my friends like to make fun of their bad spelling and their lack of any real knowledge of Confederate history. But this is what our schools are creating, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, read 5 minutes of Howard Zinn, and you'll see that half of what you learn in school isn't correct. You know. Yeah.
We have just about a minute left. Do you have any recommendations for people in terms of avoiding the bad and finding the good in entertainment and culture in the U.S.?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are groups that can help you to help your children be media literate. I think it's worth the search. We cannot count on the MPAA to properly rate for violence in these films. So you really do need to search out and write to these filmmakers, write to these video game creators, you know, ask them for something that's proper for the children, you know. Look outside the country if you need to. Like I say, the Hayao Miyazaki films, not all of them, but a number of them are, you know, there's not gratuitous violence. When there is some, it's I think, legitimately added. I have a Facebook page called Media Monsters Are Against Kids. My website is www.mediamonsters.us. And if I can do anything to help, please let me know. But Common Sense Media, there are a number of groups out there that are really trying to help parents to become media literate. You can teach your children to be media literate and not just, you know, if you take a minute and say, wow, did that character handle that well, you know, for instance.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
Wonderful, wonderful stuff. We will put those links up at talknationradio.org. Heidi Tilney Kramer's book is Media Monsters, Militarism, Violence, and Cruelty in Children's Culture. Heidi, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. Thank you for the work you do. Very important.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, one would hope that all of those who side-eyed Donald Trump's assertion back in January that recipients of the immigration program DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, quote, shouldn't be very worried. I do have a big heart, close quote, would greet with equal incredulity the administration's line, as they terminated the program, that they did so after carefully evaluating its constitutionality and determining it conflicted with existing immigration laws. But while plenty of coverage is skeptical of Trump, are media really understanding what the program does and doesn't mean for recipients? Tina Vasquez is immigration reporter for Rewire. We'll talk with her about DACA. Also on the show, as we record, Hurricane Irma has battered the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico and is currently coming down on the Dominican Republic and Haiti. This while Texas continues to reel from Harvey, both hurricanes made more destructive by climate disruption. Amid the questions, one thing seems clear. Corporate media have to move beyond asking what America has learned from Harvey or Irma or whatever comes next, because America is not univocal. Some have learned at tremendous cost, some already knew, and some are thoroughly invested in preventing others from acting on what they learn. Harvey revealed another aspect of the oil industry role here, adding toxic chemicals to the air and water during perhaps unprecedented but not unpredictable weather events. We'll talk about that with Shay Wolf, Climate Science Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. It's a big show, and we're going to get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Now there are thousands of people marching in the street across the country in support of the immigration program DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Democratic lawmakers are speaking out in support, thus demonstrating what the Washington Post called a lurch to the left. And corporate media are presenting a clear for and against battle over the program that allowed some 800,000 people who came to the U.S. as children to legally work, drive, and travel outside the country. But if the against argument is obvious and obviously bogus, they're criminals who steal jobs while somehow simultaneously draining welfare, the argument of supporters and recipients is not always especially thoughtfully explored. Tina Vasquez is the immigration reporter at Rewire. She joins us now by phone from North Carolina. Welcome to Counterspin, Tina Vasquez.
Thank you for having me.
While it's being covered in some places as an issue, you know, a litmus test for Democrats or some sort of political volleying on the part of the White House, you heard from a number of young adults who were recipients of DACA, and they had a nuanced understanding of the program. But first, they were clear that it had improved their lives in meaningful ways. What were some of the things they talked about? What has DACA meant for them?
I mean, there are overarching things that are very clear, you know, because it provided work authorization and allowed people to get driver's licenses. There are still challenges, even if you are a DACA recipient, when it comes to going to college, because in states like mine in North Carolina, they still have to pay out-of-state tuition, which is more than three times the cost for citizens. And so there are still a lot of hurdles, but generally speaking, it allowed people to get better-paying jobs. It allowed them to get jobs in their fields of study. It dramatically increased the type of jobs that they were able to get in terms of how much they were paid, what kind of benefits they received, and enabled a lot of people to go to community college, to go to state universities. So those are just kind of the big picture stuff. A young man that I interviewed from North Carolina was very clear in that DACA for him and for a lot of people in his community helped in ways that American citizens maybe take for granted in terms of having a driver's license and being able to safely drive his siblings to school or his parents who are undocumented and who are afraid to drive or having any sort of interaction as undocumented people with law enforcement. He was able to drive them out of state to visit other family members. He was able to travel within the United States and have the proper documentation to be able to show TSA. Before, that was very scary for him. He only had his Mexican passport. So just things like that that we don't think of, and then maybe larger overarching things that have really improved their lives.
Well, we know that the right-wing story is false and driven by anti-brown and black immigrant animus. Let's not say anti-immigrant, you know, because come on. But I know that many advocates want to caution us from what is sometimes presented as the counter-argument, which is this line that, unlike their parents, DACA recipients didn't do anything wrong. You know, the phrase through no fault of their own comes up a lot. Or that really, you know, all of them are working three jobs and going to college at night, you know. And it isn't that DACA recipients aren't striving, but that picture, some folks seem to suggest, even if it persuades some people in the short term, it's not really long term all that helpful.
If I'm speaking to a person who has DACA or an undocumented person and they use that sort of framing, that's up to them to do. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the framing that I use in writing about DACA, I avoid phrases like dreamers. I avoid the narrative, you know, that they came here through no fault of their own or that their parents brought them here and is, you know, it's not their fault. They shouldn't pay for their parents' mistakes because these young people were undocumented before they received DACA. DACA is not a permanent legal status. It's simply a program. And so that kind of language, to me, demonizes their parents, and it demonizes who they were before they received DACA. And I don't think that's helpful to anyone. Their parents made very hard choices to come to the United States. And using that framing isn't at all necessary to illustrate why removing DACA, rescinding DACA is so harmful and so tragic to young undocumented people or young documented people.
Can you remind us just a little bit of how we got to DACA? Because, I mean, certainly we know that immigrant advocates fought for it, but it wasn't that it was exactly their first choice, you know. What was some of the trajectory here?
The DREAM Act has been in play since 2001, and so now there's talk of the DREAM Act again, and based on people that I'm speaking to and people who've been in the immigrant rights movement for a very long time, it's like sort of reopening a wound. And young people were very, very invested in the DREAM Act and in it providing this pathway to citizenship. And then it just never happened. And then Obama became president and there was lots of talk of comprehensive immigration reform and large immigration moves that were supposed to be made within his first 100 days of office. And that never happened. And so young people began demanding some sort of administrative relief. And DACA has been called a lot of things, from amnesty to citizenship. It's neither of those things. It doesn't provide a pathway to citizenship. But at least for two-year intervals, they knew that they wouldn't be deported. They knew that they could work and they can go to school. And that's all that it's been. But it was very hard won by young undocumented people. And it wasn't just something that was given to them by President Obama.
Right. Well, the implication now from media is that there's a possibility that Congress might save DACA, but that seems like a rock that bears looking under. I mean, are there concerns about what it might mean to have Congress work out a deal on preserving DACA?
The primary one is the one that's sort of constant. It's that immigration and undocumented immigrants are constantly being used as this sort of bargaining chip. So while helping one population of immigrants that we've deemed acceptable or young, good people that we should be giving these things to, that demonizes another group of people, and it's often their parents. And so the way this is often set up is that one group of people has to suffer in order to be given other things for other groups of people. And I think with border wall funding, that's certainly a concern. I think to save DACA, that's what will be proposed, and that's throwing, you know, millions of people under the bus, and that's also really troublesome because the border exists. It's heavily militarized, and it has been since President Obama funneled billions of dollars into it and hired many, many Border Patrol agents. It's just, it's unnecessary, and people that I've interviewed who live in those communities will tell you how unnecessary more border wall funding is. But I think that's the game that's going to be played in order to save DACA.
Yes, I heard NPR say that Steve Bannon had convinced Trump to, quote, spare Dreamers and use them as a strategic asset in the coming immigration policy battles, close quote. And I don't think spare means they're what they think it means.
Right.
Going forward, of course, there's a lot of uncertainty. But some of the people that you heard from said, you know, we're not most worried about falling out of status. We've been out of status, you know, but the database does concern them, not just being newly deportable, but, you know, being so easily findable. I mean, is that, that's a concern that you're hearing?
Yeah, that's one that's being expressed a lot. I mean, just the amount of information that the Trump administration has and the way that it's already utilizing it when we look into how the Voice Office is structured and the DHS Vine database, which, you know, has the location and identifying information of undocumented immigrants that are in ICE custody and detention centers, and that anyone can sort of go and look up their status updates on their cases and where they are. And now you have this DACA database that not only just includes things like biometrics and personal identifying information for young DACA recipients, but also information on their family and places that they have lived, which also endangers their families who are mixed status or who are undocumented. So it's really, really troublesome. And there is little reason to have good faith in the Trump administration and in thinking that they won't utilize or weaponize this information.
I wonder, finally, how you think journalists can contribute to that paradigm shift, to that shift from, you know, let's help the children and punish their parents and that sort of thing to a more kind of holistic understanding of immigration. What would you like to see change in reporting?
I don't think that we should assume that we know the framing that will help different populations of immigrants under attack right now. A lot of young people that are protesting right now aren't just doing it for themselves and doing it for DACA, but they're doing it for the 11 million undocumented immigrants that currently reside in the U.S. and, you know, who are their family. And so asking people what would be useful for people to know, you know, if you're interviewing someone who has DACA, what do you want people to know? What do you think is being missed by the media? You know, what are some misconceptions that you think are out there? Let them sort of pave the way. You know, they're living this and they know what's best.
We've been speaking with Tina Vasquez, immigration reporter at Rewire. You can find her work online at rewire.news. Tina Vasquez, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
The story of devastating weather events like hurricanes is many stories, really. There's no need to compete. They're all critical. But there is something about the oil industry spurring climate disruption, lobbying against preventative or preparatory measures, and then adding to its harmful impact with their methods of operation. As Texas continues to reel under the effects of Harvey, it's been noted that, besides massive flooding, some communities were also faced with the release of dangerous chemicals released into the air by refineries and petrochemical plants. How did that happen, and what can prevent it from happening again? Our next guest has been investigating that. Shay Wolf is Climate Science Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. She joins us now by phone from Oakland. Welcome to Counterspin, Shay Wolf.
Thank you for having me.
Well, most of us are not scientists, of course, but we do understand that not every multi-syllable word is dangerous. So it isn't just that chemicals were released in South Texas. It really matters what those chemicals were. Fill us in on what your analysis found. What were the emissions and what caused them to be released?
The South Texas coast where Harvey hit, just to kind of set the context, is just littered with hundreds of fossil fuel and industrial facilities that store large amounts of dangerous chemicals. We looked at the amounts of air pollutants that refineries and petrochemical plants in South Texas reported releasing either during Harvey or after Harvey into surrounding communities, and it was a staggering amount. Our analysis, which was as of August 31st, so the number has only grown, we totaled more than 5.5 million pounds of air pollutants. And of that, we looked at 7 particularly dangerous chemicals that were released into the air, all of which, you know, are documented to have serious health impacts and some that cause cancer. And we totaled almost 1 million pounds of those 7 particularly dangerous chemicals. So those are things like benzene and butadiene, which are carcinogens, you know, cancer-causing chemicals. We also included sulfur dioxide and hydrogen sulfide. Those are chemicals that really cause a lot of respiratory irritation. So we've heard reports of people complaining about difficulty breathing or, you know, burning eyes, burning lungs in the Houston area. And that's very concerning because these are communities living in some of the worst air conditions in the country because of all of these facilities. And then during storms, they get hit with an extra load of toxins. And that's just not fair. These communities shouldn't be having to live with this toxic burden.
Well, what happened at the refineries and plants that caused these chemicals to be released?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There are several sources. Some of the chemicals were released because of leaks due to storm damage. So there were 6 facilities that reported that the roofs on their tanks that are holding the chemicals failed during the storm and released toxins onto the roof, and a lot of those escaped into the air. So things like benzene, that carcinogen. Many of the chemicals came from routine industry practice during storms when they do quick shutdowns, either before or in some cases during the actual storm, which is dangerous for workers, you know, having to go out and do the shutdown during Harvey. The industry uses flaring and these pressure release valves that release a lot of the toxins to the air. And the problem is that's allowed. There are pollution control technologies that should and could be implemented on these facilities to reduce the toxic burden during the shutdown and then the startup of the plants during storms.
Well, let me just ask you, the media coverage that we've seen on this issue seems to be overwhelmingly focused on one company, on Arkema, where emergency workers had to move things around and were made ill. But even when those stories were good, and some were, they kind of suggested that this company was an outlier or maybe even unique. But you seem to be saying that these sorts of problems are really not confined to Arkema.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, Arkema was very dramatic because of the explosions that were very dangerous. But in our analysis, those 5.5 million pounds of air pollutants and growing, there are many more now as companies continue to report, that came from 40 facilities, so 40 refineries or petrochemical plants. And there are many more now that are reporting, so it's a widespread problem.
Well, I have read industry officials describe the situation during Harvey as unprecedented. An Arkema official said, "We've never experienced anything that would have given us any indication that we could have that much water." You note, though, that, I mean, they certainly had ample warning of hurricane risk. So what's the disconnect here? Are they asking us to accept unprecedented as meaning the same thing as unpredictable? What's going on?
I think that statement is a real problem because we know that the Gulf Coast is very vulnerable to hurricanes and major storms that can cause damage to these petrochemical plants and refineries. And we also know that climate change, climate disruption is intensifying the power of these storms. So the fossil fuel industry is inherently unsafe to public health and to our climate. And then climate change is just making these facilities even more dangerous because the damage from storms can be more intense. This is a problem that's not going to go away. It's just getting worse as climate disruption increases.
There seems to be a problem with also the status of just access, public access to information. Matt Dempsey from the Houston Chronicle has spoken about the difficulty he had getting a chemical inventory out of Arkema. And apparently these companies can use the threat of terrorism, of terrorists learning what these chemicals are, as a way to defeat or get around the public's right to know? How are you able to get what information you can get?
I think you've identified a really critical problem, and that is, you know, in its short time in office, the Trump administration has really increased community vulnerability to the pollution from fossil fuel industries during storms like Harvey. And it's done that in a number of ways. And one way is that there's been several rollbacks of really important public safety protections, right-to-know protections. And one big mistake that the Trump administration made was to delay the implementation of a chemical safety rule that required companies to make information about the dangerous chemicals at their plants more easily accessible to the public, and also that increased the enforcement of company safety plans in worst-case scenarios, like we saw in Arkema. And even though that rule wouldn't have in itself prevented that explosion in Crosby from happening, it would have given the public and first responders better information about what was going into the air and what the risks were. So it is very disturbing and troubling that the Trump administration has delayed the implementation of this right-to-know, really important public safety rule. Our information from some reporting that chemical companies are doing, the rules have been suspended and relaxed on reporting during and after Harvey, which is a problem, but some companies are reporting. So once again, you know, our numbers are probably a vast underestimate of what's actually going into the air. And another thing that was very worrisome is what's going into the water, because we have seen initial reports of companies reporting wastewater outflows and overflows, sometimes onto the ground. One company reported wastewater flowing into San Jacinto River. So these are wastewater from refineries and petrochemical companies. They're most of the time not reporting how much and what's in the water, but some companies have reported 100,000 gallons, 350,000 gallons of wastewater flowing out of their facilities. And that's tremendously disturbing because, as we know, a lot of communities are dealing with homes that have been soaked in floodwater, and there could be a problem with dangerous chemicals getting into the floodwaters that have soaked their homes and their communities.
I just saw a story in which an official was saying, yeah, don't let your children play in the floodwater. You know, don't let them touch it. And if they touch it, then wash them off. It just seems not tenable, really.
It's very, very frightening to know that your neighborhood is been soaked in water, and in many places the floodwater is still surrounding your home. That could be dangerous, you know, not only from the petrochemical facilities and refineries, but also from all of the Superfund sites that have toxic chemicals that have been flooded. And there's been a lot of reporting on 13 of flooded Superfund sites in the Houston area, Corpus Christi area, that may have damage where chemicals can be leaking out. And that's really scary for the communities around those sites. I saw some reporting this morning of kind of globs of mercury washing up in Houston, and they're not sure where those globs of mercury are coming from.
Wow. So, wow. You get the sense from media that there is a problem, but that the problem is that these companies didn't submit to the regulatory system as it currently exists, where the implication is that would have prevented this. A New York Times story talked about how this is going to bring fresh scrutiny on whether these plants are adequately regulated. Is it your sense that we have all the necessary rules in place and they just need to be followed, or they just need to be enforced?
I think there's a multifold problem, and one is that the fossil fuel industry is exempt from the provisions of many of our foundational environmental laws. So just to give you an example, there's an Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act that requires industrial facilities to report like big releases of toxins so that the community can know, and the oil and gas industry is largely exempt from that requirement. So that has to change. The oil and gas industry should not have exemptions from protections provided by environmental laws. So in some cases, many cases, the rules and regulations aren't sufficient, need to be stronger. And in other cases, there is not proper enforcement. So, you know, we already know that, you know, under the Trump administration, there's been tremendous cuts to staffing and funding for environmental protection agencies like the EPA or OSHA. And so we have agencies with a mission of helping protect Americans from toxic pollutants, and their staff and budgets are being cut, and the enforcement then isn't there. So we know, like, for example, during Harvey, that a lot of the air quality monitoring devices were turned off. So during the most intensive part of when pollutants are being put into the air, we don't have a lot of independent verification of what went into the air beyond what the chemical companies are self-reporting. And then we need a lot of comprehensive, like, monitoring on the ground of what went into the air, the water, the soil, so we can comprehensively clean up communities. And then we need more prevention in the future so these things don't happen again. And that is, it's worrisome. That is not happening on the level at the scale that it should be.
Well, finally, we still have those talking about the climate change agenda, but in large part, media have moved. They acknowledge that human-driven climate disruption is real, and they're reporting the impacts in the United States anyway. But this never-ending call for fresh scrutiny makes me nuts. You know, at some point, I guess we have to ask whether journalists' job is satisfied by simply narrating destruction, or are they charged with really naming the causes and naming the ways toward solution?
Yes, and I think that's really important, setting a different vision, laying out what this really looks like in practice on the ground, and that it has to be, we need to make change on a more rapid scale. I mean, we know from all of the hundreds of thousands of scientific studies and what we're seeing just with our own eyes, that in order to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, we need to phase out fossil fuels very quickly. And we need to phase in clean energy from rooftop solar and wind that creates clean, good jobs, and it protects our climate and protects people and the environment. And having a more recognition of what that looks like in practice and the absolute need for that. I mean, it could not be a more critical point to be talking about over and over again, because this is our future. This is our present and our future. What's happening now with the storms and the other climate change related damage is unacceptable. It's just getting worse. And there couldn't be a more critical issue to be talking about with our friends, with our neighbors, in the media, with our colleagues all the time.
We've been speaking with Shay Wolf, Climate Science Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. They're online at biologicaldiversity.org. Shay Wolf, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. You can check out more information about FAIR on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to another season of Radio Eco Shock, where the strange new climate is already happening.
When the power goes off, you can expect it to be off 3 to 7 days.
This week on Radio EcoShock, we have two reports on the major weather event that could reshape America and the world economy, the unbelievable Hurricane Harvey. But that's not all. At the same time, even worse floods have killed thousands in Africa, India, and East Asia. That's part of global wetting as the warmer oceans feed more water vapor into the heated atmosphere. On the other side of the jet stream, fires continue in the western states and around my home in Canada. That's after a disastrous fire season in Portugal, Spain, and Italy, more fires in Siberia, and even on Greenland. I'm going to squeeze in some of the jaw-dropping headlines you may have missed this summer. I'm Alex Smith. When a major weather event strikes, Bob Henson is deluged with media calls. During the summer, when we agreed to talk, we had no idea a monster storm for the history books would strike Houston, all of East Texas, and Louisiana. It is far from over as we speak, but let's get an update from the author of one of the most widely used college textbooks on weather. Bob Henson worked at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. He's the author of The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change. I read Bob's reports often at Wonderground, the Weather Underground hub. Bob Henson, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you, Alex. It's great to be back.
Well, you know, we have a fire emergency right now here in British Columbia. There's smoke out there in the air, but it's nothing like the tragedy unfolding in Houston, Texas. Bob, talk to us about some of the records this strange event called Harvey has set.
Well, the records are still tumbling pretty much as we speak, but there's some records that we already know are completely gone, and quite a few, actually. I mean, I think the headline in terms of records is that this is by far the most rain that's ever fallen on a major U.S. city over the course of a few days. I mean, not just by a little bit, but by a lot. Basically, the Harris County is pretty much synonymous with Houston. You know, the city limits, I believe, are almost the same as Harris County, if not identical. And the heaviest rain pretty much encompassed the entire county. So that was one of the dimensions of the tragedy. But in that area, in Harris County, and in actually a broader area that is, you know, almost the size of, say, Rhode Island, rainfall totals were above 30 inches, in some cases above 40 inches, which is a phenomenal amount. For those of you in the metric system, more than a meter, you know, to have that much fall in a few days, even for a wet area like Houston, is really really devastating. When you translate that into recurrence intervals, which is what are often known as return periods, or say a 1 in 100-year event or a 1 in 1,000, the amount of rain we're talking about over Harris County is, you know, roughly a return interval of 500 to 1,000 years. It doesn't mean it would recur that often like clockwork, but on average, over many, many thousands of years, you would expect something like this to happen about every 500 to 1,000 years. So an enormous, enormous amount of rain. We knew this area could rain heavily. It's just not usually over this broad an area and not usually centered right on Houston. So those were some of the really intense aspects of this storm. It did set the record already for the highest amount of rain to fall from a tropical cyclone in the U.S. The old record was 48 inches, set in 1978, also in Texas. And at last check, the most highest official total from a reliable observer was 49.32 inches.
Wow. Well, you know, I have seen archival footage showing that Houston has flooded before, as you know, back from 1935 on. Does this big storm compare to that previous flooding, or is this something else again?
I would say this is something else again. I mean, certainly Houston has had big rains, And a lot of the flooding, for example, the events in 1929 and 1935, a lot of that flooding occurred because the city hadn't really figured out how to deal with its waterways. So you had waterways like Buffalo Bayou that head from West Houston into downtown. And so those would just become rampaging rivers, and in a heavy rainstorm, it wouldn't necessarily have to be a gigantic one, just a flash flood type setup. And as a result, the city decided to develop two big reservoirs that sit west of downtown about 15 miles. And those are called Attucks and Barker. And that's been a pretty interesting story the last day or two in itself, because those reservoirs were designed to hold basically a 1,000-year flood event, which is somewhat different from a 1,000-year rain. You can have a 1,000-year rain, but it may not necessarily cause a 1,000-year flood. The flooding depends on the landscape and, you know, not only how much rain is falling, but how much has fallen in the last few weeks, say, and whether it's falling on pavement or absorbent ground. In any event, those reservoirs were designed to handle a 1,000-year rainfall, and they began overtopping. Attucks Reservoir, the water began to flow around the spillway for the first time since these dams were built in the 1940s. So we're still going to have to see how high the water goes and how high it stays high, because these dams are not in the best of shape, and there's no sign of imminent collapse or anything, but this is certainly going to make keeping those dams together a bit more challenging.
You know, Bob, I don't fully understand why Harvey would stall over Houston and East Texas like that. Why didn't it move on like other storms do?
That's a very good question. And in fact, you know, this is one of those quirks of weather. Sometimes the currents that steer tropical cyclones, the upper-level winds that we think of as the jet stream, but in fact they permeate the whole atmosphere a few miles high, sometimes there's just little areas we call call areas, which means the winds are just have just collapsed. There's just no wind there. The flow is all going in other directions, and that's exactly what happened to Harvey. It moved up just west of Houston, and then there was simply no air to cart it away, and it sat there. This is not super common or frequent, but there are really vivid examples. I mean, for example, 1963, Hurricane Flora might be one of the closest analogs. That's a hurricane that moved up toward Cuba and then basically stalled and did a small loop, just like Harvey is doing, and then moved on off. But it actually dumped on the order of 100 inches of rain on Santiago de Cuba.
That's a crazy amount of rain. You might as well just go underwater for a while, like the ocean or something.
Yeah, if you live in a dry climate, it's kind of hard to fathom or picture that much rain in a short time.
I can't imagine it. And of course, you know, making it worse, as you kind of mentioned, is Houston is such a big sprawling city, and there's so much concrete and so much pavement and buildings that there's nowhere for the water to go now that would have formerly just gone into the ground or found ways into the Gulf.
You're absolutely right, Alex. I actually went to college in Houston at Rice University, so I spent 5 years there. I vividly remember seeing fellow students taking kayaks to the streets of campus one time during heavy rain. And I was actually in Houston in 1979 when the United States 24-hour rainfall record was set, and that was 42 inches in one day. And this storm has not yet topped that record, to my knowledge. It's gotten close, but that one may be really difficult to pull down from its pedestal. But there are many other rainfall records were set. So it wasn't so much that one spot got, you know, a record amount in one day, but that a large area got a record amount over several days. And obviously that puts huge stress on hydrologic systems.
Well, now the sheer magnitude of that endless rain reminds us of a hotter, wetter atmosphere. Do you think climate change is a contributing factor to what happened with Harvey?
Oh, absolutely. It's in the mix. The way I've been thinking of it is hurricanes are natural phenomena. They're happening in an atmosphere that is not natural. It's not the same atmosphere that we had 50 or 100 years ago. You know, quite literally, the carbon dioxide, which obviously the leading greenhouse gas added to the air by humans, that's up basically 30% since the industrial age, and more than 10 or 20% since the 50s. So these are natural events. You know, hurricanes have been around as long as we know, but they're happening in this climate context that is different. So it's almost as if you have different ingredients in the kitchen, or you're stocking more and more of certain kinds of ingredients, and the chef just waltzes in, who normally makes meals, but there's just a little more spice in one meal or something because there's just more spice available. I mean, it's kind of a crude analogy, but the idea is that the ingredients that go into all weather systems, you know, we've always had systems that have stalled. We've always had heavy rainers. Climate change is associated with a lot of the factors that made Harvey worse. We know in many parts of the world that the heaviest rainstorms are becoming heavier. This is a really well-established finding, very consistent with what we would expect with science theory, that you've just got more moisture in the atmosphere in a warmer climate. There's more evaporating from the oceans, and that gets concentrated and squeezed out when you have a big rainmaker like Harvey was. And in addition, storm surge is higher, and that's a very definitive link to climate change. You know, oceans are higher, so when you get a hurricane, you've got a little bit higher storm surge. Now, that wasn't a particular issue with Harvey. There wasn't really that much storm surge damage, but certainly the rainfall and the storm's ability to intensify rapidly. Hurricanes need warm water, and the waters in that part of the Gulf are on the order of about a half degree Celsius warm, or about a degree Fahrenheit, as a result of climate change. Now, they were also about a degree Celsius above average for this time of year, but that can happen any time. That could have happened 100 years ago. So I think the more relevant index is what is the long-term warming in that part of the world. And you know, every time you boost the ocean temperatures by degree, you add a few percent to the amount of moisture that can be in the air. So I think that's a very relevant link. I think all these things say that, you know, Harvey is worse because of climate change. It's a very hard thing to prove, just as it's hard to prove that a certain cigarette gave you lung cancer. It's really something you diagnose over long periods of time, looking at many storms or many cigarettes. But certainly the distinctive aspects of Harvey relate pretty closely to climate change, both observed climate change and expected climate change.
Yeah, I've been doing this for a few years, and I've never seen so many reports of extreme rainfall events all over the world. So it's just like a new phenomenon that keeps blurting out over the weather. You know, when it comes to Houston, there were multiple reports warning this kind of flooding could hit the city, and the city says it was prepared, but not for that kind of rainfall. Bob, I'm wondering, do you think Houston can adapt to this, or is it going to have to give up some ground, maybe permanently?
Houston is a challenge when it comes to floods, although a lot of cities are. But I think the Houston psychology, kind of the way Houston sees itself, having lived there a while, I think that makes it a challenge, because Houston is kind of famously a very laissez-faire place. You know, there's very, very little zoning. You can, in some senses, almost have a church next to a strip mall, and nobody seems to care much. The city prides itself on being able to do things its own way and to have as light a government hand as possible. And that leads to a really dynamic economy at times. But, of course, the downside is that the less planning you have, the more vulnerable you are to events like this. One thing that really amazed me that I discovered just the last few days is that these two reservoirs in western Houston, Attucks and Barkers, those are what are called dry reservoirs. They were built in the 40s, not to hold water for the city to use, but simply to be retaining basins when you get a heavy rain. So normally they're dry. They're covered with grass and trees, but they're also partially covered with houses. There's private land abutting the reservoir on the other side of the dams, and there are houses there in the 500-year floodplain, is my understanding. And sure enough, with Harvey, just in the last couple of days, those houses have flooded. And there are probably a few cities in the country that would have a setup like that, where houses are adjoining a reservoir literally on the back side of it, with the knowledge that they could flood. And in fact, now they have. So the civic philosophy of Houston makes it tough for it to adapt. Certainly the amount of growth they've had, the gigantic amount of pavement. In fact, the watershed behind Attucks was built in the 40s, was essentially entirely rural. It's almost 50% now urban. And so you've got water pouring off concrete. You know, there's so much just existing infrastructure in Houston. I'm not sure how they're going to take the next steps after this, but I know there will be a lot of attention put to it. And, you know, hopefully some creative thinking and some ways to at least kind of come to terms with it.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're doing a bit of radio storm chasing during Hurricane Harvey. Our guest is the senior meteorologist, author, and blogger Bob Henson. Well, adding to your point, you know, when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, thousands of people fled to Houston, and some stayed there, so it's possible some folks are getting flooded out for the second time. When this is over, you've got, last I heard, 9,000 people in one convention center and more coming. There won't be enough homes for them all. Those homes will be damaged. They have to be rebuilt, replaced if they can be. there could be an exodus again, as it was from New Orleans, this time from Houston. What do you think?
Oh, I absolutely believe there will be to some extent. I mean, this is a civic tragedy, and I believe over the coming days we're going to see just how bad it is. It's one thing to get a quick flood in a house where the water comes up and then a few hours later it goes down, but I think in many of these cases you're going to have water in homes for several days, and I think that makes it a lot harder to restore a house. And you've got thousands upon thousands of homes that have been flooded. It's going to be really tough. Even some of the homes flooded behind Barker and Attucks Reservoir, because those the reservoir waters have to drain down gradually, some of those houses are going to be underwater for a month. So there is going to be, I think, a housing crisis in Houston. I think there's going to be a lot of the same angst and stress and anxiety that hit after Katrina in New Orleans. It's a bigger city and probably an economy that could bounce back a little bit better than New Orleans in some ways, but there's still going to be a lot of pain and suffering. I should note that I have already heard of firsthand stories I've seen on TV of folks who were drowned out in Katrina, went to Houston, and now have lost everything again. So very, very, very heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. And, you know, another part of this is we don't know how much the storm will cost or whether governments can even cope with the recovery or how long it'll take to restore that Houston region, if it can be. But if it takes a long time, it's possible that another big flood could happen even before Texans manage to get over Harvey. Are the odds increasing that extreme rainfall events will strike again along the Gulf of Mexico?
I believe so. There has been some good work done, for example, by Climate Central in the last couple of years, in particular following the what we call the no-name flood in southeast Louisiana, which was just last year, where a tropic-like system, it wasn't technically a tropical cyclone, but it was like a very weak depression-type storm, moved from the Florida panhandle very slowly westward across Louisiana and dumped 20, 30 inches of rain over a couple of days. And Baton Rouge and some other areas were really hit hard. It was the most expensive U.S. disaster of 2016, more than $10 billion in costs, and many people flooded out without insurance. So in response to that, Climate Central did some work and found that the likelihood of that kind of rainstorm along the central Gulf Coast has increased and will continue to increase. And it just seems to be what's happening. You know, it's a little hard to suss out how much of a particular flood experience is because of the way the land's been built and developed and how much is due to the rain. But certainly in Houston, the flood events have become worse. You know, the record flood in Attucks Reservoir was the tax day flood of 2016, so just 2 years ago. And so in the whole last 70 years, the two worst floods have been in the last 2 years. And I think that's a pretty telling index.
Yes, indeed. And just in the news, the Indian megacity of Mumbai was also crippled by incredible rains and floods at the end of August. And we may get to the point where a disrupted climate challenges this whole model of very large urban areas, or maybe it's the other way around. Megacities are the focal points for disrupting the climate. Bob, what do you think?
Well, certainly megacities have a lot of people that affect the climate. You know, there can be efficiencies in cities. I mean, the carbon footprint of many New Yorkers, for example, is quite low because they live in a densely populated area. They don't use as many resources, maybe, as folks living in a sprawling acreage. If those folks fly a lot, though, then, which I fly more than I ought to for the sake of the climate, then you can have a very large footprint. So I don't know if urbanity itself makes climate change worse. Certainly, if cities are in the developing world or places where people can live more lavish lifestyles, then you may have more carbon emissions. That's why I think it's important to do some leapfrog technologies so people, for example, go right from maybe having no power to having renewable energy instead of having to have coal-driven power in between. But getting back to the point about the way cities are built and events like floods, yes, a lot of big cities are on waterways or coastlines because people like to live near the water. And the larger city is, the harder it is to get people out. The more flood-prone it can be because of all those impervious concrete surfaces. And I do think that basically water, or flood water, is going to be one of the more and more one of the big natural disasters of this century that we just have to deal with.
Well, you know, when these things happen, the media tends to flood in with a big spotlight, and then people get a bit bored with that news, and something else happens, and the floodlights move on. But what should we be watching for as the after effects of Hurricane Harvey unwind?
Well, this is going to be a big test. For example, President Trump has emphasized infrastructure both in his campaign and since he took office. So if there were a golden moment for infrastructure development, I would say Houston is a good one because there's going to have to be a lot of development of the dam system. There may need to be a lot of road reconstruction, perhaps drainage systems. So I think this is a real opportunity to be innovative and creative with infrastructure. Unfortunately, it's going to take money, and it doesn't grow on trees. Or some early estimates I've seen, really ballpark, back-of-the-envelope estimates are, if just, say, 10% of the homes in Houston are lost, that would be roughly $30, $40 billion in damage. And then when you tack on the thousands of lost cars and other damage, we're probably talking a Katrina-level hurricane, if not worse. So probably the costliest hurricane in U.S. history when it's all said and done. And one thing to watch in particular is many of these folks who have lost everything do not have flood insurance. In the United States, we do not have a private flood insurance model. For many folks, the only place to get it is through the government. And if you're not in a 100-year floodplain, you're generally not required to get flood insurance to have a mortgage. So being the humans that we are, we'll put off costs unless we think we're going to have to pay for them down the line. So many folks in Houston, I think only 1 in 6 homes are covered by the flood insurance program. Even that is going to throw a number on the program because the program is already $25 billion in debt. This could add tens of billions more. So the government is facing a twofold tab. It has to bolster the flood insurance program, which is actually right now set to expire at the end of September. So this is going to be a real high-profile event. And as well, there's going to probably be what they call a supplemental bill to pay for a recovery for Harvey, just as we had for Sandy and Katrina. And that could be on the order of tens of billions of dollars. And these dwarf some of the things like the ask for funding for a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. So there may be some interesting political battles ahead.
We'll be watching for that. We've been talking with Bob Henson, the veteran meteorologist, journalist, and storm chaser from Colorado. When it comes to major weather events, there's no one better, in my opinion. Find Bob Henson at wonderground.com and follow him on Twitter at bhensonweather. Bob, on behalf of our listeners, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Alex. Take good care.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Covering the world. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This summer, I took time out to walk the river trail, to grow some of my own food, get the firewood in, to love life and the earth. I should be happy, but instead, I'm angry. This great life is becoming the facade which hides much greater evil. More than ever, we are being played. Whether it's Vladimir Putin scheming to replace democracy with right-leaning autocrats around the world, or the Koch brothers spending millions to feed our doubts about climate change, it's all heading in the same ugly direction. Yes, I've been entertained by the greatest geopolitical drama of this century. I checked the Twitter feeds of Claude Taylor at True Facts Stated and Louise Mensch to get the inside track on the Trump investigations. But all that is just a shadow of the goblin that is rearranging the atmosphere, the poles, the oceans, and the landscape. The demon is us. Just consider the hoped-for recovery from Hurricane Harvey. Just now, Canada has an extra 400,000 barrels a day of heavy oil from the tar sands, with no place to go. Pre-Harvey, it was processed in the refineries in Texas. Nobody else can do it, so the price of Canadian crude drops, along with the Canadian dollar. We're told up to 500,000 cars and trucks were rendered useless by the hurricane floods. It took a lot of carbon to make all that steel and plastic. Just when the car industry was heading into another cycling slump, we'll get an additional burst of warming carbon just to replace the Harvey-damaged vehicles. With what we know now, we shouldn't be making another single internal combustion engine. Let's spend more billions of dollars, hundreds of billions, on concrete and heavy equipment to replace the roads and freeways for those carbon burners. Let's spend another $500 billion on more building materials and shipping to replace all those homes. Of course, since we believe in freedom no matter what, people will put those roads and homes right back in the flood zones. That's partly because officially climate change does not exist. It cannot even be named in some departments in the new federal administration or in Texas. Planning to avoid the next disaster is prohibited by law. That's how deadly crazy things have become. Maybe because I work on the fringes of the media, I'm maddest at the media. We have some good work on the Russia investigation from a few big newspapers and a couple of cable news outlets. But even they fall into stories about puppy dogs, shallow coverage of big storms with lots and lots of flag waving. It's one big propaganda machine. Take this coverage by the American cable channel MSNBC. Finally, after a million hours of climate silence on the other networks, they stumble on a correspondent who wants to stand in the middle of a Texas flood and tell us how it is. Let's listen in.
Joining us live on the ground in Beaumont, the first camera to get there is my old friend Shihab Ratansi, Al Jazeera English reporter. His hotel is surrounded by water. He cannot get out of it, but he's got a shot. Shihab, what's the situation as you've seen it?
We're surrounded, as you said, as so many people are in Beaumont. We can take a look. I mean, we're at an island of calm, an oasis of dryness relative. But already this water is beginning to come up over here. This is I-10 behind us. Sections of this are now closed. Down there is Louisiana. That's the road we took to get here. The whole section moving to Louisiana is now shut, we understand. It's interesting listening to the mayor, though, just then, because we were listening to the mayor as well last night. If you were a resident in Beaumont last night and you're watching local television, you would have been reassured by what the mayor said, by what the weather forecaster said. This wasn't going to be as bad as this. I remember the mayor talking about all the investment they've done in drainage for roads and things like that. It's pretty clear something has gone wrong here with the forecasting and with the preparation. Clearly, the roads are now waterlogged. We understand 500 roads just in the southeast region are flooded. Actually, let me put this in context. I know you were talking to someone in Port Arthur a moment ago. We're in what's called the Golden Triangle in the south. Now, you know, it's interesting. The reason why it's called the Golden Triangle is because this is the first place in the United States where they discovered large quantities of oil in 1901.
Right.
And that led to the Texas oil boom and the huge amounts of money come pouring into this region. It's pretty clear, though, that despite that, money has not been flowing into this region for the infrastructure, for the climate change effects that we knew were inevitable because of the oil and gas industry's activities on this coastline, even as those oil and gas industries were covering up what they knew about climate change in the 70s. I have to go on about this. Ali, you're an Al Jazeera guy. We get to the point on Al Jazeera.
Yep.
So that is very striking for us here. So much money has been made on this region,
Shihab,
and it hasn't gone into the infrastructure to deal with the climate change that was inevitable because of the industry.
Hold that thought for 1 second, because on the screen we've got a live helicopter rescue. I believe I'm going to ask my control room. This is in Beaumont. Miguel Almaguer, I believe, is on that helicopter. They have lowered the basket to get somebody from the water. This is a Navy helicopter.
That's right. Just as the Al Jazeera reporter winds up to explain how Texans have been fleeced and left in danger by the oil industry, the camera gets whisked away to watch another helicopter rescue of some human. It's like calling squirrel to a dog. They can't resist. So after the unsuspecting gentleman is hauled up into the helicopter and into our living room screens, our MSNBC host manages to get back to his man on the ground. That reporter begins to wind up again about climate, big oil. Well, oh my gosh, they lose the connection, and they move on to another meaningless real TV opportunity. Even the most left-leaning network just can't handle the truth. Sad. I'll be right back with Zoe Carpenter from The Nation.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Remember Hurricane Katrina revealed shocking poverty in New Orleans and ongoing pollution from petrochemical plants? Add millions more people and the world's largest chemical corridor, and you've got Houston, Port Arthur, and all that, after Hurricane Harvey. But as Wen Stephenson wrote in The Nation magazine on August 29th, Houston's human catastrophe started long before the storm. While the mainstream media grandstands with weather porn and pictures of dogs being rescued, let's go to Zoe Carpenter, associate editor for The Nation magazine. Zoe, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
It took a couple of days before we saw even brief photos of flooded refineries on ABC or Fox News, but the reporter never explains what that really means. What is the real story lurking there?
Well, the real story is that although this natural disaster was beyond anything that we've experienced before on the Gulf Coast in recent history, there were lots of warnings and lots of things that could have been done to at least prepare better, especially when it comes to the chemical facilities, when it comes to the development in the area. And I think the overarching story is that as we look ahead, these kinds of extreme weather events are going to challenge many more of our cities. And if we don't actually start looking forward instead of just rebuilding and assuming things are going to be the way that they were in the 1970s in terms of flooding and things like that, this is just going to keep happening.
Why does Wen Stevenson say the catastrophe in Houston started long before Harvey arrived?
Well, part of it is, you have lots of factors here. So the catastrophe partly is related to development. There's been unchecked and relatively loosely regulated development in Houston into floodplains, which covers up prairie that used to absorb some of excessive rainfall. Of course, it wouldn't have absorbed all of 50 inches, but it would have absorbed some of that flooding. That prairie has now been covered up by concrete. You have building into low-lying areas that regularly flood. And then you have this pre-existing disaster of especially poor communities of color living near petrochemical plants, living in areas that are dangerous. And so that disaster has been around for decades.
And an estimated 80% of Houston residents don't have flood insurance. According to a new Harris poll, 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck if they have a job. What does the devastation of Hurricane Harvey mean for them?
Well, for them, it means a very uncertain future. You know, I think we're still in the stage where people are just starting to return to check out the damage of their homes in some cases. I think most of this week we've been focused on the immediate safety concerns. But for the people that don't have flood insurance, many of them may be unable to rebuild their homes, or if they're renters, you know, imagine if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you're renting an apartment and suddenly all of your furniture is ruined, the car that you depend on to get to work is no longer functional. These could be serious life-changing circumstances for people with no clear way for how to get out of them.
You know, when I heard that dozens of doctors volunteered to attend the Houston Convention Center to help evacuees, I thought this may be the first time some of those people have seen a doctor in years. They can't afford medical care. Talk to us about the health impacts of living in America's oil refinery.
Well, there are many, and they compound upon themselves. So there is evidence that rates of certain cancers are higher in communities near the petrochemical facilities. And again, those are largely communities that are lower income and of color. So there are serious environmental justice concerns. Now with the hurricane and the flooding, we have other more acute health issues related to infections from the water. There are many communities that don't have access to potable water right now. And then, of course, you have the larger problem of health insurance and lack of access to care more generally. So the Houston population, about a fifth of it is below the poverty line. Texas is very strict in terms of its requirements for eligibility for Medicaid. So you have these sort of chronic health issues that may have been exacerbated by the flooding. People who need access to dialysis, need access to medicines, who need to see a doctor, who may be pregnant and need to see their prenatal physician, now suddenly will face more barriers just to accessing basic care.
And when those refineries shut down, including America's largest, they don't just turn off a tap or turn out the lights. The Houston Chronicle was reporting that, quote, 2 million pounds of dangerous chemicals were released in Houston when they shut down between Monday and Wednesday. More has been released since then, and millions more will be released when the plants restart. Zoe, have you heard more about that?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that these refineries really aren't meant to be shut down and restarted the way that they were forced to. And so what happens is when you shut them down and restart them is you do have these excess emissions. And the companies file these reports, but they don't get sanctioned for these emergency emissions because it's an emergency situation. So the impacts of that obviously fall upon the communities that live most closely to those refineries. And many did report unbearable chemical smells in the air, and many of them weren't able to evacuate. So not only have they been living near these petrochemical plants full-time and experiencing sort of the daily cumulative effects of those chemicals, but now they're trapped near this sort of acute, drastic emissions because of the storm. And I think one thing to keep in mind is that this isn't just accidental. The Texas politicians and the companies themselves have worked for many years to weaken or prevent regulation from these companies. So Arkema, which is the chemical plant, where there have been a couple of explosions this week, they refused to release their chemical inventory so that we know exactly what chemicals might be being emitted from that plant. And they've also lobbied against a recent rule that was released under the Obama administration called the Chemical Disaster Rule, which would have put in place some more emergency measures and better audits and things of that nature. And recently, Scott Pruitt, the new EPA administrator, actually put a hold on that rule. So, like I said, this isn't just an accident.
And with up to 100,000 homes destroyed or just damaged in Houston, there have to be hundreds of thousands of people, I guess, displaced people. Do you think the government of Texas or the federal government will get them the support they need in time and continuing as they need it?
It's hard to imagine that every single person who has been displaced can be compensated properly for what they've lost. I think that's an unrealistic expectation. I think certainly there will be an effort to get emergency money to people and to have temporary housing. But I think the lessons from past disasters, even on a much smaller scale, such as the flooding in Baton Rouge last year, is that certain communities don't get all the help they need to fully recover. That means people living for years with tarps where their roofs used to be because they aren't able to rebuild their roofs. People living in FEMA trailers, and those are supposed to be temporary measures. But we see what's referred to as a new normal settle in, where measures that were supposed to be temporary become permanent as people don't have the support to fully regain what they lost.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Zoe Carpenter of The Nation magazine about some of the underreported news from Hurricane Harvey. Zoe, after watching tons of coverage, hardly anything on climate change is mentioned, much less the role of oil and petrochemical companies in helping cause climate disruption, denying global warming is happening, and making sure there's no regulations to plan for it. Your comments?
I think the conversation, when it does come up, is often framed in a really twisted manner, and people want to know whether we can say with certainty that this hurricane is due to climate change. But that's not really how climate change works. Climate change, it's not like it's some minion that's going to pull a string a weather disaster is going to occur. Basically, climate change means that the climatic conditions are changing in ways that lead to weather events being more extreme, for example. And so one of the ways in which climate change is very clearly linked to Hurricane Harvey is that as the temperature of the world increases, even just a bit, you have more moisture in the atmosphere, and that's just because of basic laws of physics. And then you also have more movement of that moisture. And so in the case of Houston, we saw that the Gulf of Mexico was much warmer than average temperatures. It was about 1 degree to 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer than historically average temperatures. And that meant that there was more moisture in the atmosphere, which led to so much rain being dumped. And another link is because of the way wind patterns and the way that the Gulf Stream has changed in relationship to climate change, the shifting wind patterns led or may have contributed to the hurricane sitting over the Houston area for so many hours and, you know, for days, in fact. And so those are some of the ways in which climate change is linked to Harvey. And it doesn't really matter whether we can say that climate change, quote unquote, caused this hurricane. What matters is that we know to expect more of these extreme weather events. And that it's really negligent, to say the least, not to prepare for that coming reality.
I feel like there are 1,000 stories in Hurricane Harvey. We'll be working on this for some time to come. Is it going to change the course of life and history in America, or is it just another blip along the road to a broken climate in a broken system? What do you think?
Well, it certainly will change the course of history for individual people and for individual families whose lives will take a dramatically different course because of this. Whether that gets written in the history books or not, you know, I can't say. I think that, unfortunately, the response from the right politically to this has been consistent with the past, that they're not willing yet to entertain a conversation about climate change. It may change the minds on the individual level, which I think is important. But, you know, part of the problem here is that even if people become more interested in preparing for extreme weather events, it's really hard to prepare for 50 inches of rain in a several-day period. There's only so much we can do. So, yes, we should prepare, but the bottom line is we actually have to do something to mitigate climate change, to stop it from proceeding along its current course, not just adapt to it.
Well, and I think, you know, Texas has its fair share of preppers, and I like to be prepared myself. And certainly if you have some water at home, that helps you when the water supply stops. But if you have to get out of your home, that doesn't help you so much. And I think The Nation ran another article talking about how everybody's an individualist and a libertarian until a catastrophe strikes, and then we're all supposed to be more socialist.
Of course, there's the sort of petty hypocrisy that you can see from some members of Congress who objected to using federal funding for Hurricane Sandy relief, and now they want federal funding for Houston. You know, that's obviously silly, but I don't know that it's worth spending too much time making fun of those people. I don't know how productive that is. But, you know, I think the larger point is that we celebrate the sort of local acts of communalism. So the Cajun Navy coming to help out people in Houston, and that's great. But we shouldn't have to rely on individual acts of heroism to respond to a disaster. This is what government is for preparing for and responding to wide-scale communal disasters. This is a community event that deserves a community response. And by community, I mean not only the individuals that make up a community, but their representatives and their government.
And also lost in the massive coverage by American and international networks is another series of floods in India, Pakistan, and East Asia. Over 1,200 people have died there. You know, why don't we hear in depth with 24-hour coverage about the floods that happen on another part of the world as opposed to what happens in America all the time?
It's troubling. I don't know exactly why. I mean, I think that's part of our inward-looking media culture. And certainly the disaster in India and in Bangladesh, and it's much faster than the scale of what's happened in Houston, and certainly deserves our attention. And I think that's what we can expect in future years, is that we're going to have these wide-scale disasters that happen in multiple areas of the country, or sorry, multiple areas of the world.
Why is it that The Nation magazine often publishes unpleasant truths when the big news organizations won't?
Well, one reason is perhaps that we're not beholden to our advertisers. You know, we're an independent publication, and, you know, nobody's pulling the strings over there.
Good point. Same here. And as we wrap up, as a journalist, Zoe, what are your impressions of what this record-breaking extreme rainfall event really means as we head into the future?
Well, I think it means that reporters can cover climate in many different ways. And climate change reporting isn't only about extreme weather events, but when we're covering development in a coastal city, does that story include information about sea level rise? When we're talking about immigration and we're talking about all of these other things, how is climate part of the story? And I think that's sort of one of the news lessons to take away from this.
Well, for me, one of the challenges is not to get totally distracted by every disaster, because there's going to be more and more of them, but also to keep my eye on the science and what we really know about our situation and, of course, the solutions. What are we going to do as a society? Are we going to stop driving around in oil-based cars and trucks? What are we going to do? You know, that is a real challenge, not to get focused on the weather porn, I think.
Yeah, but at the same time, I do think it's worth, you know, keeping an eye on how individual communities are impacted immediately by the disaster. And I think that we've seen some really amazing local reporting coming out of the Houston Chronicle and other places that is really providing vital resources for the people who are in the area and need information. And that is certainly still a very important and worthwhile function of the news as well.
I agree. I'm still digging. I want to put some links in my show blog at ecoshock.org to some Texas environment groups who have been working on these issues for years and get them out there for our listeners as well. Zoe Carpenter has appeared on MSNBC, CNN, and other outlets. She regularly writes for The Nation magazine. She's the associate Washington editor there. Follow her on Twitter at Zoe S. Carpenter and check out thenation.com. Zoe, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
And now for a Radio EcoShock roundup of all the news they didn't tell you this summer. As you've heard during the interviews, there were even large floods in eastern Nigeria, Africa, as well as Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh. At least 1,200 people died during floods in East Asia during August, and millions are homeless, without any food or hope of government aid. You can Google it, and BBC News in the UK are one of the few English-language networks to cover that. Regular listeners know that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a report on extreme weather events, which will increase as the world warms. I've done several programs on extreme rainfall events dating back to 2008. The atmosphere has warmed over 1 degree C, which allows it to hold 7% more water vapor. That means more rainfalls somewhere. It's simple physics. And then there are the fires. I was surrounded by them again this summer. We had more smoke alert days than clear days. It was very hot here, well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 35 degrees C, day after day. There's been no rain here for almost 2 months. This isn't summer as I ever knew it. In Canada, British Columbia declared its second ever state of emergency as hundreds of forest fires erupted. It's cost about $750 million to fight them. Tens of thousands of people were evacuated, including from cities. Gigantic valleys burned. The smoke drifted over 1,000 miles to the east. Aboriginal people have been evacuated from northern Manitoba and Saskatchewan provinces as more fires burned there. Crops withered in the key grain-growing parts of southern Saskatchewan. There were major fires in California, Oregon, and Washington as this broadcast goes to air. The West is burning again. That's another predicted outcome of climate change, but even the best scientists did not expect it this early. Let me just skim through some of the headlines that would have been world affairs before these turbulent times. I'll read through them, and you can follow up what interests you through the links posted in my weekly show blog. That appears every Wednesday by 6 p.m. Pacific time at ecoshock.org. In North America, a drought in the western plains threatened some of the wheat crop. Sacramento was hit by a record-breaking heat wave. People who attended the Burning Man Festival this year in Nevada suffered through 100-degree Fahrenheit heat, not seen there at this time of year since the 1940s. And they got a massive sandstorm that filled every tent, RV, and nose. It was apocalypse now for those folks at $1,000 a ticket. In July, in nearby Death Valley, California, they set a new global record for the hottest single month ever since official records began in 1911. The East Coast hardly saw a beach day for the month of July. It was strange. New Englanders were on the cool side of the great bending jet stream that's been changed since the Arctic sea ice melted. A heat wave swept over the Arctic in Canada with severe fires in the Northwest Territories. It was the same in Siberia and Russia. Heat, fires, and smoke. We can only imagine the amount of carbon released there, especially when the peat catches fire. And as I've told you, there were fires on Greenland. That's not unheard of, but it's pretty strange to get ones that big. Moving on to Europe. In early August, the Telegraph reported the European heat wave, which killed five, with temperatures soaring above 40 degrees C. In France, wildfires forced mass evacuations in late July, especially along the Mediterranean. As you no doubt heard, there was a sad incident where over 60 members of a Portuguese village were killed trying to flee a fire. The fires in Portugal were declared a public calamity. The great city of Rome faced an unusual water shortage with rationing. Even the Vatican shut off its fountains. Extreme heat decimated crops in Central and Southeast Europe, exposing the riverbeds not seen for centuries in places. Overall in Europe, it was called the Lucifer heat wave, which led to a higher death rate and crop damage. Summer skiing at one Italian glacier was shut down for the first time in 90 years, just another sign of the times. Turkey experienced strange and severe storms. Government workers in Iraq were laid off due to blistering heat. Birds were reported falling dead from the sky when temperatures in Kuwait went over 50 degrees C or 122 degrees Fahrenheit. An eastern province of Nigeria was recently hit by super floods, with countless people losing their homes, cattle, and all their belongings. I've already reported on the super monsoon floods that hit northern and eastern India, leaving hundreds of thousands homeless. In late July, there was another extreme rainfall event and flash flooding in the Kingdom of Bhutan. Torrential rains crippled Karachi, Pakistan on August 31st. The Indian financial capital of Mumbai, formerly Bombay, was shut down by heavy rains and flooding on September 1st. India got 10 times the usual amount of rain within a 10-day time period. Bangladesh was also hit by the super rains. More crisis there. Not much on your television screens. Meanwhile, new science on climate change concludes parts of Southeast Asia will be, quote, unlivable by 2100. Scientists also say living in Pakistan will be difficult by the year 2100 due to long-lasting extreme heat waves. During all this, fossil fuel use is rising, not falling. Yes, greenhouse gas emissions have fallen in America, but the U.S. is still a gigantic source of climate-damaging gases. The rest of the world is trying to catch up and live as the U.S. does, and they're more than filling the American decline. Scientists are reluctantly admitting that the world is almost certain, that's their words, to warm by 2 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. Believe me, that is a disaster far greater than you or I have ever known. One British investment firm, Schroders, which controls assets worth $542 billion, is far more pessimistic. They think 7 to 8 degrees C of warming is possible. Experts are predicting more humid heat waves, the most dangerous kind for mammals. Another report predicts heat waves up to 55 degrees C or 131 degrees Fahrenheit. That's from the European Joint Commission, and I hope to have the lead author of that report on Radio EcoShock perhaps next week. By the way, did I mention new science shows global ocean circulation is beginning to collapse due to a warming planet? All life depends on that circulation. And last year, 2016, was once again the hottest year ever recorded, according to the State of the Climate in 2016 report. That's led by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, and plus scientists from 60 nations. 2016, hottest ever, once again. And I bet you 2017 sets a new record. Outside my home, it's now too smoky to go outside and breathe. One valley to the west, a new fire erupted last night in the Okanagan, near Peachland. In the extreme heat and high winds, it went from 40 hectares to over 1,000 hectares, about 2,500 acres, overnight. In this area, which was already housing evacuees from fires further north, a fresh round of evacuation has already begun. There has been no rain there for a couple of months. The grass, shrubs, and trees are as dry as can be, literally tinder. The sun, shadowed by fire clouds, is blazing red. The hills and the ground are tinted with the colors of sunset at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Something deep inside me, something from our animal roots, something from a million years ago tells me how wrong all this is, how dangerous these times are becoming. There is no end to apocalyptic headlines. While recording this short feature, the largest fire in Los Angeles history popped up. As of September 2nd, the La Tuna Fire grew to over 5,000 acres, according to the LA Fire Department. Homes in Burbank and Glendale were evacuated. Los Angeles has fires from time to time. I've lived there, I know. But keep in mind, this is again a record, the largest ever. It was 91 degrees in LA, but with the humidity, it felt like 104 degrees or 40 degrees C. To the north, San Francisco broke an all-time record high for September 1st. Broke isn't the right word. Jason Salmonow at the Capital Weather Gang says the record was smashed. San Francisco on the sea is known to be cool even in summer. They were not ready for the hottest day ever since records began. It was an astonishing 106 degrees Fahrenheit or 41 degrees C. The previous high was 3 degrees lower than that, and that was in the year 2000. The average high for this time of year in San Francisco, Jason tells us, is around 70 degrees Fahrenheit or 21 degrees C. So this September 1st was more than 30 degrees above normal. That's got to tell you something. Is all this getting through? We are already in a global climate emergency. That is the real news. Anything else is a distraction. This is the time to fight for our survival and to turn back the tide of extinction. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock as we ride through these turbulent times together. Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues?
We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith.
Actually, you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life.
Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No fear, Deep Green Radio EcoShock. Join us. I've left a small personal story of climate change for the end of this program. It's not a big thrill like the footage from Hurricane Harvey or the fires in France. It's small, but I think there is a point. My family traveled to a nearby mountain lake this summer, as we do every year. We camp out without any electricity except for our small solar panel. One day as we headed out to get more supplies, we saw a massive cloud erupting to the south, tinged with red. We were seeing the start of a forest fire that caused more hundreds to evacuate their homes, this time near Kelowna in British Columbia. As we attempted to get back to the lake, a big windstorm blew through, taking down power lines along the road. And that road was closed by the police for a few hours while the power lines were removed from the pavement. No big problem. We waited and then got back in. At the end of our week in paradise, we drove through another forest road to get home, except there was a fire there. Traffic was only allowed through, 30 cars at a time, escorted by the police. We saw Canadian Army men helping, as firefighters filled big vats of water for the helicopters to pick up. The roadside was black, trees all burned. After a couple of hours, we got through. Getting home, the air was thick with smoke. It was hot and unhealthy to be outside. But we know how to live with that. Our home is very tight, with two HEPA air cleaners that can take out the tiny particles before we breathe them in. Unfortunately, I'm going to recommend that for everyone in the West and everyone where a fire can burn. You should have a HEPA air cleaner. It's a special type of air cleaner. I work inside when that happens on the radio program. Well, automated sprinklers keep my garden alive. Everything survives out there. But the tomatoes stopped flowering. We will have no fall tomatoes this year. It's a peculiarity that even the professional growers noticed when smoke fills the air. The point is, as climate change gets worse and worse, humans will adapt. And that is the problem. We are so very adaptable. We keep on living the way we do, driving around. I mean, nothing should stop our holidays. We have to get to work. Even as hurricanes flood out homes down the road, or fires burn out neighboring cities. Nobody really considers questions like, should we stop driving carbon-based cars? Should we stop buying food or flowers flown in from other countries? Should we really change? I used to think that climate-driven disasters would finally bring the public to their senses. We would take action on a grand scale to save nature and ourselves. But now, looking at my own life, I'm not so sure. Maybe our ability to adapt is what will keep this fossil parade marching right off the cliff. Maybe adapting is the worst policy. I am taking steps to change. A listener and longtime friend just donated an electric bike. I'm so grateful. Now I can go around my village and buy groceries and all that without using fossil fuels. We burn wood in the winter, which saves all kinds of carbon. Trees capture carbon from the atmosphere, so burning it adds nothing. I know we can't all burn wood, especially in cities, or the forests would be doomed. But what I'm talking about is there are options that each of us can take if you look around. My geothermal greenhouse is half built now. The pipes are in the ground. and I finish the concrete block foundation, I hope there is some room to grow food year-round without using fossil fuels. It may even cool the plants during extra hot summers. I'll report more when that is operational. We capture hundreds of gallons of rainwater for the garden from our roof. Use those eavesdrops. We buy used clothing and goods when we can. Don't make new carbon that way. There are a lot of small steps each of us can take. And we not only reduce our carbon footprint, but we lead our neighbors into a more climate-friendly lifestyle as well. Preventing a climate disaster, it's a direction that each of us can take. Please consider what you can do, even in small ways. It could add up, pushing us towards the big change we all need so much. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and please try to catch the show, every show, this season.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
It's always been about not being afraid, you know, and the reason why we put our mural up on that wall is to say we're not afraid in a time where fear is like the biggest component of how the state is trying to control us.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. We're at Reams, a new bakery and cafe right next to the Fruitvale BART station in Oakland. Reams serves Arab street food to a growing and dedicated clientele. For several years, local activist Reem Asil sold her traditional Palestinian, Lebanese, and Syrian sweets and flatbreads at local farmers markets around town. Asil began gathering recognition for her baked goods and was featured in mainstream publications like Bon Appetit magazine. Positive reviews kept coming from Bay Area food writers. In 2016, she won OpenTable's National Open Restaurant Contest, which helped fund her vision of a brick-and-mortar cafe. In May of this year, Asil opened Reams with the intention of carrying forward the values she held as a longtime community activist. She committed to hiring staff who face obstacles to employment, including women, people of color, immigrants, refugees, and the formerly incarcerated, and to paying them a living wage in the increasingly expensive Bay Area. When my family and I visited at lunchtime on that opening weekend, it was so popular that they had already sold out of food. We're at Reams during a Thursday lunchtime rush. There are customers eating and working at the tables. The staff is taking orders at a fast clip while the line of customers spills out the door. In the busy kitchen, one staff member is stretching fresh dough across a hot, domed griddle, while another is pouring a drink for a customer's order. Reem's specialty is the manouche, or flatbread, sprinkled with traditional Palestinian spices, or cheese, vegetables, yogurt, eggs, and other locally sourced toppings. Another popular choice is the pali kali, a flatbread wrap stuffed with sumac-braised chicken, caramelized onions, and arugula.
Can I ask you what you just ordered?
Sure. I just ordered the pali kali and a hibiscus rose cooler.
Have you had them before?
Yes. I eat here almost every day, actually.
Awesome. What do you think about what's been happening to Reams and to the staff here?
I think it's horrible and frightening and shameful. And also, I know that the community here knows what's up and are behind Reams 100%, and anybody who just comes here will know that this is a place for community and coming together, and it's really delicious. So, yeah.
Thank you. What's your name?
My name's Caitlin.
What Caitlin referred to are the continuous attacks against Reims by groups of Israel supporters who began showing up shortly after the cafe opened. The groups harassed customers and staff, blocked the entrance, and even applied pressure on local institutions that support the cafe itself. These right-wing groups have been protesting a mural that Asil had commissioned a local artist collective to paint on the wall of her cafe. A huge image of Palestinian-American community organizer Rasmia Odeh smiling against splashes of neon greens, pinks, yellows, and blues. In the mural, Odeh is wearing a traditional Palestinian checkered scarf, or kefieh, and a button commemorating the young black father, Oscar Grant. Oscar Grant was shot in the back and killed by BART police on New Year's Day 2009 on the subway platform just a few meters above the cafe itself. Odeh is the associate director of the Arab American Action Network, where she founded the Women's Committee that is credited with organizing and empowering hundreds of immigrant women. In 2013, Odeh was indicted by the U.S. government for failing to disclose her conviction and imprisonment by Israel in 1969 for alleged involvement in two bombings in Jerusalem, which killed two civilians. While imprisoned by Israel, Odeh was subjected to prolonged psychological and sexual torture and rape by Israeli soldiers, which Israel used to force her to sign a false confession. Odeh has always maintained her innocence. When she was indicted by the United States in October 2013, Odeh again maintained her innocence, taking her case to trial instead of accepting the plea deal that was offered at the time. She was convicted in a trial in November 2014, but won an appeal in February 2016. She was prepared to go to a new trial to argue that she had failed to disclose her conviction and imprisonment by the Israeli military on her immigration forms due to her post-traumatic stress disorder. But during the preliminary phase of the new trial, federal prosecutors expanded their indictment against Odeh, adding charges that she was a member of a, quote, terrorist group, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a secular Marxist-Leninist political organization. At Reims in Oakland, Asil has not only refused to cover up the mural of Rasmia Odeh and cede to the demands of these right-wing groups, but has been outspoken in her and her staff's support of Palestinian rights and Rasmia Odeh herself. Sitting at the cafe's outside patio, while Arabic pop music blared from a speaker, Sarah Kirshner of the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network and the National Lawyers Guild told the Electronic Intifada that
because Reem and Reems is unapologetically Palestinian and this place is about sharing that culture and cuisine as well as the history of fighting for Palestinian rights, it's now being targeted by people who are extremely racist and Islamophobic and who want to shut down a Palestinian business and are particularly enraged that Reem has chosen to honor Rasmia Odeh, who is a very powerful Palestinian leader who's been organizing women around their rights in Jordan and in the United States. And so they show up periodically, and because we're not interested in really trying to criminalize anyone, we've called on community to be here and just ensure that Reams can continue to stay open despite their attempts to close it, that when they are aggressive as they have been and attack people, that we're able to defend people and also protect this space and the people in it. Really, also just we believe that the best way to really support Reams is to really make it a community space, honor it as a movement space, and enjoy it as a great place to spend time and get some good food.
While we were recording on August 17th, a handful of Zionist protesters stood facing the front door of Reims, holding placards denouncing Rasmia Odeh. At the same exact time, thousands of miles away in Detroit, Michigan, Odeh was at her sentencing hearing, surrounded by dozens of supporters, where the judge in the case sentenced her to time served, a $1,000 fine, and the loss of her U.S. citizenship. Her case is now in the hands of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, whose agents will decide when she will be required to leave the country. Here's Odeh in her own words, addressing her supporters outside the Detroit courthouse after her sentencing hearing on August 17th.
Really, I want to clarify for all of you, we will continue to struggle for our cause. We will liberate our Palestine! More Palestine! And I want to thank all these people who's coming to support me, not just today, the whole 4 years they supported me. Thank you very much. Even there's people, there's families in the hospital, and they are in bad situation, and they are coming here to support me. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Over the summer, attacks against Reams escalated after members of the Israel lobby group Stand With Us began inciting against the cafe and, according to reports, led a protest in front of the business in June. In July, a story smearing Reams was published in Breitbart, the right-wing propaganda website run by Steve Bannon, until recently an advisor to Donald Trump. The story described Rasmia Odeh as a, quote, Palestinian terrorist. Other right-wing, anti-Palestinian sites published similar attack stories, while individual Zionists from across the world began trolling Reem's public Facebook and Yelp pages with attacks and bad reviews, hoping to permanently damage the cafe's reputation and discourage customers from supporting the business. Zionists have also harassed local organizations that support Reem's. Last month, Reem's was included on a tour highlighting women of color in the Bay Area food industry. The tour was organized by COESA, the Center for Urban Education about Sustainable Agriculture, which helps run local farmers markets. Israel supporters began sending emails to members of the COESA board and to the bank that was underwriting the tour, demanding it pull its sponsorship. According to Reem Asil, the tour was canceled a week before it was scheduled to take place. Although she couldn't comment on the reasons the tour was canceled, Marcy Coburn, executive director of COESA, told the Electronic Intifada that they are supporting Reem Asil as a food justice entrepreneur and are working with her to reschedule the tour. Coburn told the Electronic Intifada that, quote, "We believe in her as a food maker in this community and want her here and want her to feel safe and supported that she can run a viable business and feel good about what she's putting out into the community." The kind of harassment Reems has been facing fits within a larger pattern of ongoing attacks by anti-Palestinian groups in the Bay Area. Asil noted that in 2011, Israel-aligned organizations pressured an Oakland Children's Museum to cancel an exhibition of drawings made by Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip. And in San Francisco in 2007, artists were forced to remove images from their public mural depicting Palestinians breaking through Israel's illegal wall in the occupied West Bank. The San Francisco Arts Commission, which sponsored the mural, was under sustained pressure from influential Zionist groups, including the Jewish Community Relations Council, the JCRC, and the Anti-Defamation League. Here's Reem Asil.
So any voicing of Palestinianness or Palestinian identity or Palestinian voice, they try to go after the things that's the institutions that support that. This opposition is so strong that they're trying to like infiltrate and attack anyone that's remotely connected to me. You know, they're going to try to isolate me, but I know my community is strong. I know that the relationships I've built are, you know, stronger than this, stronger than a set of bullying, so, you know, that we will prevail over this. You know, I feel very hopeful in that light.
Asil added that although she expected some racism after opening her bakery, she wasn't prepared for the extent of the violent backlash and the impact it would have on her.
You know, as Reem's got more in the limelight, you know, we... You know, thankfully, I feel very blessed that we got a lot of really good press leading up to the opening of the bakery. And, you know, somebody told me, be careful if you're a successful Palestinian. Like, the more you are in the limelight, like, the less under the radar you are, the more you're going to get attacked. So the first sort of inclinations of it were email threats and people sort of saying nonsensical things over email, but then the sort of second wave of it was through a series of coordinated Yelp attacks in which people were giving me one-star reviews, and, you know, some of them were outright, like, racist and xenophobic and Islamophobic, you know, and some of them were just, like, lies, pretending that they had eaten my food. And that was really scary. And, you know, as a business owner, you know, I had to be strategic and I didn't want to escalate, you know, like that's what your opposition always wants you to do. And so we sort of swallowed that and just sort of, okay, let's let this sort of fly under the radar. And like people who know Reams and who've ever experienced Reams would like look at these reviews and say this is bogus. But unfortunately, you know, after a couple of weeks, so our opening was in mid-May, you know, I finally, I mean, I couldn't take it anymore. It's like only so much that you can get threats and phone calls and people saying they're going to come and like shut you down, that I, you know, appealed to my community. And I was so shocked because I essentially asked my community to like show up for Reams and to like attest to, I didn't tell them to like write a review. I told them to write a review like based on their real experience at Reams. And within like 2 days I had like, you know, 100 Yelp reviews. And unfortunately, because, you know, my side like went and told the truth, then that caused an escalation, in which we had to actually shut down our Facebook because it got trolled so badly. They just infested it. They were so incessant about their attacks on Facebook that they actually attacked another Reims bakery in Qatar. which was poor folks who were like a home bakery that did like food delivery, and they got attacked. And so, you know, these folks don't, you know, they're just like incessant on like trying to shut you down. They're not even doing their research. They're just like hate, you know. So yeah, it was definitely like a online disaster. And then, you know, we sort of let it play out. I think I got a community support network together, and we planned for the worst, you know. And luckily it hasn't gotten to the worst, and we hope, but, you know, we're living in a Trump era where you just don't know, like, even here in the Bay Area. And on July 8th was the first time that they actually showed up to my restaurant, tried to disrupt business, tried to block our doors, you know, attacked several of our customers. And yeah, that was a wake-up call for me and my staff that, like, we need to really be coordinated, and we need to make sure that we're protecting one another, because nobody else was protecting us. So.
And how did you organize that response, you know, in this? I mean, it's kind of ironic that the Resmia mural, Resmia is wearing Oscar Grant pin, and Oscar Grant was killed by BART police, yeah, just, you know, what, 50 meters, yeah, from where we're sitting now. But in having to organize a response to protect the safety and well-being of your staff and your customers, were the police involved? How did you organize that and coordinate it, and also, like, you know, balance out these kind of dueling narratives of we need to be protected, but also the police, you know, especially in Oakland, are not here to protect us. How did you do that?
I mean, I think that, you know, Reams has a very explicit line on how we engage with the state, and that is non-engagement. And that's actually put us at a disadvantage, because the police actually know Reem's line on law enforcement, you know, given our mural and given, I mean, I think nothing more than our mural and maybe like them looking up my political activism. I mean, we're a welcoming space to anyone as an individual that comes in, but I think it's like very known that like we don't, you know, we don't call the police unless we absolutely have to. We have like a very sort of explicit line with our employees, but we also have networks of folks that are alternatives to the police. So like we're engaged with a network called the Lightning Bolt Network, where we, you know, like talk about emergency preparedness and, you know, like what are the things that we can do to protect one another should things happen, so that we don't have to rely on the state. Because as we know, being right here in the Fruitvale, we know how that turns out when we rely on the state to protect us. When it came to the protesters, you know, the folks who manage this station have what they call community ambassadors. But if there's a perceived threat, their made it thing that they have to do is call the police. And in fact, the first time that the protesters came, they called the police on us. And so these police show up and they don't really actually know what to do. And yet they have no problem with like pushing homeless folks off with force, you know, or, you know, but like when it came to these protesters, they just didn't know what to do. And so it was actually just like mayhem, like the first two times the protesters came, because you had, you know, all these protesters, the community ambassadors, and then these police that just, like, didn't have any idea of what to do, or, like, didn't use their power to actually protect us. And it just goes to show that, like, and you know, what we hear is that they think that we have, they're, like, afraid of us, which is ridiculous, you know, that, like, that their emotions are getting in the way of doing their job once again. Yeah, that the police's emotions. They think that we, they don't want to protect us because they think we have an orientation to them, you know, and that's just like, you can see who gets protected and who doesn't get protected, you know, and so, you know, for us, like, we know that there are contradictions. We know that, you know, two of these people are violent and, you know, we have filed restraining orders to protect, you know, my security as a person. But then also the security of my staff.
In response to the attacks on Reams, activists representing a broad spectrum of community organizations have joined the cafe's defense team, including members of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, Jewish Voice for Peace, and other social justice groups, and Filipino, Chicano, and Black-led anti-racism organizations. Again, Sarah Kirshner.
It's just been so incredibly powerful. Some of the people organizing against fascism, what kind of gets grouped as the anti-fascists, have been here defending Reams, really supporting Reams. So it's really been a show of our ability to defend our organizations, our communities, and our businesses when they are under attack by these extremely racist, white supremacist forces of different kinds. You know, the people who have been coming here are virulent anti-Arab racists, anti-Muslim racists, Islamophobes, and they are also very, very Zionist, meaning that they believe at any cost that Jewish people deserve to have an exclusive state in historic Palestine. And here then they shut down any Palestinian who dares to sort of celebrate and honor their history. So that's what we're doing.
Nadia Tanous, an activist with the Palestinian Youth Movement, talked about the significance of having a mural of Rasmia Odeh inside this Arab bakery.
This is really Reem's statement of community and how you cannot, you know, separate food from its history and food from its politics and from the context from which it was made. And it's a tribute also to Oscar Grant, to his memory, the resistance that we have as black and brown youth here in the United States against state brutality and state violence, police brutality, and also to our elder, Rasmia Odeh, who is being unjustly deported from this country that she's made her home for the past, you know, few decades as a really active, really committed organizer. The community is behind us, whether they are Arab, Muslim, Palestinian, or not. And this is really a concerted effort that you can see across various communities. The Reams Response Network and the community members who come out on their own accord is comprised of a variety of organizations, a variety of community groups, not all of whom are from the Middle East even. This is really about connecting the struggles that we face as people of color and black and indigenous folks, the demonization that we are facing from supremacist groups, from those who wish to change or silence our narrative. And we are standing here coming out today saying that we refuse for that narrative to prevail. We are here, we are human, we are in the flesh, and we are reclaiming our history. We are telling it for ourselves. We are feeding people our food from our own hands, from our own creation, and telling that story. We're connecting it to our political context, our historical context, our cultural history, and we are not ashamed. We're very proud.
Lara Kiswani, director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, one of the groups helping to organize in defense of Reams, told the Electronic Intifada at her office in San Francisco that the attacks on the cafe are part of a broadening state of repression in the Bay Area, a place usually known for its progressive politics.
The electronic intifada.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carolina Bartoletto, an activist with the group United We Dream, who discusses what Donald Trump's decision to end DACA will mean to her and nearly 1 million other young immigrants. Angel Candelario, a Burger King employee from Hartford, Connecticut, who talks about why he participated in Labor Day protests with the Fight for 15 movement to demand a living wage and a union. And Robert Bazanko, professor of history at the University of Houston, who examines how unchecked development and deregulation of dangerous industries exacerbated the destruction wrought by Hurricane Harvey in Texas. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Since late August, nearly 60,000 Rohingya Muslim refugees have fled to Bangladesh from Myanmar's growing violence. The ethnic minority Rohingya have faced brutal repression in recent years at the hands of Myanmar's majority Buddhist population. A new wave of violence erupted after a small group of Rohingya insurgents attacked military outposts. Burma's military quickly counterattacked, burning and clearing out Rohingya villages. Thus far, an unknown number of civilians, mostly women and children, have died in violence on the border with Bangladesh. At the same time, Myanmar's elected leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, has ignored the growing refugee crisis and blasted aid groups working on behalf of the Rohingya in Rakhine State, where over 1 million Rohingya live. Over 100,000 refugees now live in camps in Bangladesh, and border guards there have orders to block new refugees from crossing into the country. Burma's army has come under intense international criticism for inflicting horrible abuses on Rohingya civilians during earlier bursts of fighting. A United Nations commission led by former Secretary General Kofi Annan warned that radicalism among the Rohingya would grow if sweeping reforms weren't initiated in the areas of human rights, security, and economic development. Laboratoria, a computer skills training school, runs coding programs in Mexico, Chile, and Peru and recruits ambitious young women to train for high-paying tech jobs that are increasingly in demand across Latin America. The program is now seen as a model for skills training to expand the middle class throughout the Americas. Over 20 million young people have dropped out of school and are now among the ranks of the unemployed. Despite widespread poverty, there is growing demand across the continent for tech-savvy, highly paid web developers. A job interview often only consists of a recruiter asking an applicant to go on a computer and demonstrate their coding skills. The Christian Science Monitor reports that coding programs help break down traditional workplace gender barriers, yet many obstacles remain, such as the expense of childcare. However, there's a big payoff for women who graduate from coding training, where many can earn 3 times their former salary. 4 years ago, President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder adopted a policy known as Smart on Crime, reforms that directed federal prosecutors to defer using harsh mandatory minimum sentences when dealing with low-level, nonviolent drug offenders. After Ronald Reagan declared his war on drugs, the average sentence for illegal narcotics for an African American was nearly 50% higher than for whites. Mandatory minimum sentences instituted in the 1980s imposed long prison sentences on drug offenders, fueling mass incarceration that increased the prison population to over 2 million in federal, state, and local prisons. After the Obama holder reforms were adopted, the number of federal prisoners began to decline. Toward the end of his time in office, President Obama granted clemency to over 1,900 nonviolent federal prisoners who were subject to mandatory minimum sentences. Now, Donald Trump's Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has reversed course on sentencing reforms. In May, Sessions overturned Holder's reforms on mandatory minimum sentences, claiming without any evidence that Holder's sentencing changes had led to America's sudden 10.8% increase in the murder rate in 2015. However, Sessions' endorsement of failed 1980s crime policies have not gone unopposed, reports the Guardian newspaper. Police chiefs in some of America's largest cities have publicly opposed the policy change, as have some conservative Republican senators. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As long expected, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced on September 5th that the Trump administration is ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The DACA program, initiated by President Obama with an executive order in 2012, benefited immigrants without serious criminal histories who were younger than 16 years old when they arrived in the U.S. before 2007. An estimated 800,000 young undocumented immigrants, 91% of whom are now employed, currently benefit from DACA protections. With this announcement, no new DACA applications will be accepted, but the administration will allow DACA recipients with a work permit set to expire before March 5, 2018, the opportunity to apply for a 2-year extension. Trump's acting Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke stated there would be a 6-month delay for current DACA recipients to give Congress time to pass alternative legislation. While making the announcement, Sessions condemned DACA, as Donald Trump often has, labeling it as unconstitutional and unilateral executive amnesty that has taken away hundreds of thousands of jobs from Americans. Your reporter spoke with Carolina Bordoletto, a DACA recipient who came to the U.S. from Brazil when she was 9 years old. Now an activist with a group United We Dream, she discusses what the end of DACA will mean to her and nearly 1 million other young immigrants and the protest actions organized in response to Trump's decision.
DACA works. It's an excellent program. I think there's a statistic that says that 91% of people who have DACA are currently working, and those who are not working are in school, usually in college. So it's been a program that has really been like a lifeline for a community. It has allowed undocumented people like me to be able to pursue their careers, to get jobs, to support their families. So taking away DACA is really, it's really a cold-hearted decision because it disrupts the lives of, you know, so many immigrant communities, immigrant families, schools, places of worship, employers. But I guess the fact is that we know that this is a possibility since the election, really. This is something that, you know, Trump ran his election on, saying that, you know, he was going to take away DACA. So we've been, what have we been expecting, but we've been kind of preparing for this since, you know, November 9th, 2016. And the fact that it's, you know, 7 months, I think, after Trump took office and we still have DACA, I think is a testament to both that it's not a politically good decision for him to take away the DACA program, and it's also a testament to the large amount of support that there exists for this program, both within the immigrant community and also outside the immigrant community.
Carolina, what kind of preparations have you made in the event DACA is abolished and you yourself face deportation, as well as family members that you arrived here with?
I guess personally, I'm not really sure what I'm going to do, but I do know that no matter what happens, we're going to keep fighting for the rights of immigrant communities, because we always know that DACA was just like a temporary stopgap measure. It's not a law. It's just an executive order. So we've known it was temporary, so we're going to still keep fighting for more.
What will the fight look like? What kind of preparations has your group locally and the National United We Dream organization made to defend DACA as the Trump administration moves to close it down?
Well, here in Connecticut, we've been trying to get our elected officials to show their public support for DACA. A few weeks ago, we got all the Connecticut delegation, Murphy Blumenthal and the five congresspeople, to sign on to a letter in support of DACA that was addressed to then-Secretary of Homeland Security, John Kelly, asking him to keep the DACA program in place. And then we also got the Attorney General to voice his support for DACA and sign on to a letter saying that he would like to keep the DACA program in place.
And I've heard that preparations are being made for a massive fast is being planned in Washington, D.C., as well as protests, rallies, and vigils across the country to bring attention on this issue. Tell us a little bit more about that, if you could.
Yes. So tomorrow, actually, about 40 or so of our undocumented youth and allies are going to get on a bus at like 4 a.m. and go down to Washington, D.C. for a National Day of Action to defend DACA. So there'll be a large rally followed by some smaller actions that our youth are going to take part in tomorrow. And tomorrow also begins a week-long fast that some organizations are organizing down in Washington, D.C. They're going to be fasting for 5 days to show their support for DACA and to show the moral crisis that taking away DACA will cause for communities. And I do believe this is a week of action down there in Washington, D.C. So we're sending people down there for the whole week, and they're going to do actions at members of Congress offices and try to meet with members of Congress to keep pushing for a legislative solution.
You know, there's been a lot of attention on white supremacist groups, the KKK, the Nazis, a lot of hateful organizations who've been emboldened by Donald Trump's election to the presidency. Carolina, what are the links in your mind between this drive by the president to abolish DACA and white supremacy that seems to have come out of the shadows since the election?
I think the effort to end DACA is really just another step forward in the white supremacist agenda of this administration. Because you know, a lot of people who benefit from DACA are people of color. So by saying that, you know, you want to take away this program and potentially deport people, what you're saying is that, you know, immigrants, especially immigrants who are of color, don't belong in this country, and they need to be taken out. So I think that the criticism of DACA, which is such an economically successful program, really has its roots in xenophobia and white supremacy.
That was Carolina Bordoletto, a DACA recipient, an activist with the group United We Dream, and co-founder of Connecticut Students for a Dream. Find links to groups across the U.S. campaigning to defend DACA by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Along with more than 300 other cities across the U.S., Hartford, Connecticut hosted a Fight for 15 march and rally on Labor Day. About 200 fast food workers, other low-paid employees and their allies rallied in front of a McDonald's restaurant, then marched 2 miles past many more fast food franchises and held a rally in front of a downtown church where workers from the food, daycare, and home care sectors talked about the need for a livable wage and a union. The National Workers Alliance, known as Fight for 15, was founded in 2012 and backed by the Service Employees International Union, which has initiated other successful organizing drives, including the Justice for Janitors campaign. With their Labor Day rallies, Fight for 15 is launching a campaign to defeat anti-worker politicians across the U.S. in 2018. While attending the Hartford Fight for 15 rally, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus met Angel Candelario, a 37-year-old Burger King employee. He explained how it's impossible for him to support his family on Connecticut's minimum wage of $10.10 an hour, especially when, like most fast food workers, he doesn't work full time. He recounts that although he was hired 7 months ago at 20 hours a week, he has since seen his hours cut in half. Here, Candelario, who has suffered from leukemia since the age of 8, talks about why he became active in the Fight for 15 movement and the importance of having the right to join and be represented by a union.
Because I started standing up for myself and fighting for my rights and actually believing in everything with this movement. And now that my management knows about me and this movement, they're not pleased with it. So now my hours got cut from 20 to 10, and I only get 5 hours each day for only 2 days a week.
Is this the only job you have?
Right now, yes. At one point, I was doing the temp agency job. I was working installations and then Burger Kings, but due to my health issues and difficulties, I'm not able to. So I had to reduce to just one job.
So how are you surviving?
I'm not. If I was to say, yeah, I'll be lying to you. But I'm not surviving. I'm actually just living off my sister or my mom, my ex-girlfriend. So that's the truth.
How does that feel to you?
Degrading. At the end of the day, it's degrading. It's it hurts, you know, man's pride, you know that good stuff. You know, a man's thing, a man's ego. But right now with this fight, it's like they got my back, though. They made me feel like, yo, it's all right. You have to stand for something. If not, you're going to fall for every single thing that throws at you in life. So for today, I'm standing for everybody, not just for myself. I'm standing for the people that was afraid to come because they might get in trouble with their job. But it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right.
First of all, if you could get paid full like for 40 hours a week, $15 an hour, do you think that would be an acceptable salary to live on?
Yes. Let's think about it, though. Our movement is called Fight for 15 and Union. If they say, okay, Connecticut, here's $15, but it's still, we don't have union, the management still has the rights and take the hours from you. So they'll be like, here's 1 day of work a week, $15 an hour, 8 hours. What then? So we want that union because the union is guaranteeing our safety. The union's going to treat us like a family. The union's going to pay attention to our hours. The union's going to make sure that once we sign that dotted line to get a job, we're going to get 30 hours, nothing less but better.
Is there a specific union that you're wanting to join?
If I was to join a union, whatever union and so forth, it's a blessing. To pick one, I didn't even know we could pick one. But if we could start our own and have our own backbone, because we not understand. Eight months ago, I wasn't part of this. I was afraid to even speak to the union because at my job, I was taught to walk away from the union. Don't sign with the union. Don't interact with the union. You're capable of getting fired if you interact with the union.
Which is illegal for them to say.
But because us men and women today don't have the proper knowledge on what is what. On what is the rules and regulations that is happening behind them closed doors. What we can or cannot do. What can you say? Who can we talk to and go above any proper chain of command? So now I'm like, I would love to create our own union. That's your answer. That's my answer.
And what other businesses or fast food places are represented here? You work at Burger King, and what are some of the other ones?
We have McDonald's. We have Burger King's. We have Wendy's. We have Taco Bell. We got under the table restaurant workers. We have people from car washes. We have secretary dentists. They want to believe in this. We have medical people that want to come over here and protest with us.
You said you had health issues. Are you getting under the Affordable Care Act? Do you have any health insurance or anything?
Under the Affordable Care Act, I have Husky. Burger King's offers medical. But if you sign this piece of paper waiving your medical rights, we can make sure that you get over 30 hours a week. That's what I was told. Excuse me. But me being a young man, naive, I signed. So now I don't get no medical, nothing. My medical's weak, and my hours are weak.
this is Burger King told you if you signed a waiver.
There's a make a waiver. If you sign this piece of paper, we could guarantee you over 30 hours because we can't really give you benefits and also provide you 40 hours. But you know, I bit the bullet because I didn't understand. I was naive. I was still immature into this rules and regulations. But now that I understand, I bet you it won't happen to the next person. I won't allow it.
Tell me, if you talk with your fellow workers, can you talk about any of the other struggles that some of your fellow workers have had to deal with making only $10.10 an hour?
I come up with in my mind, there's a gentleman, a young gentleman, that I was working with at a restaurant, under the table. Great pay because it's under the table, we get the cash, you know? But this gentleman lost a tooth. And plus, he's illegal, undocumented. And because of that, he can't go to a regular dentist. He has to pay cash to get seen as a favor because of his situation, legal situations. So that's just one of the medical. It's almost impossible. It's unbelievable. You know, that people get hurt and you can't get work compensation. You get hurt, you can't complain about it to your boss because then so what? What are you going to do? Either you get fired or suck it up. Or he'll give you one day off.
Without pay.
Without pay. So I want to tell everybody that this is what the fight. If you ever had a fight that you want to stand up for in your life, anything, one moment, one day, Fight for 15 is the movement.
That was Angel Condolario, a Burger King employee from Hartford, Connecticut, who marched with the Fight for 15 movement on Labor Day. Learn more about Fight for 15 by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Hurricane Harvey was a Category 4 storm when it slammed the southeast Texas coast on August 25th. But when Harvey downgraded to a less powerful tropical storm, it then dumped torrential rains that flooded the region with a record 52 inches in some areas. After countless homes were flooded, more than 53,000 Texans were forced to seek shelter with the aid of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. According to news reports, FEMA expects nearly 1 million applications for aid stemming from Hurricane Harvey. Houston, America's fourth largest city, is now drying out. But municipal, state, and federal officials say that it will take years to fully recover from the storm that killed 60. While President Trump has asked Congress for an initial $7.9 billion for Harvey recovery efforts, Texas Governor Greg Abbott estimated that the cost of recovery could be as high as $180 billion. Your reporter spoke with Robert Bazanko, professor of history at the University of Houston, who examines how the absence of zoning laws, unchecked development, and deregulation of the fossil fuel and chemical industries in Houston contributed to the scale of the destruction wrought by Hurricane Harvey and endangered public health.
In 2001, Tropical Storm Allison, which was the worst until this one hit. After Tropical Storm Allison, between 2001 and 2010, in that decade, 167,000 acres of green space were plowed under and turned into asphalt. And so that's really kind of the way Houston kind of reckons with these things. We have more, they keep using the word development. I don't like that word. I think it's Orwellian. But, you know, you can see maps. You know, the News to Local paper had maps of Houston, you know, over the last 5 years, the last 10 years, the last 15 years, the last 20 years, and areas where there was once, you know, parks or green space or whatever, which are now basically concrete. So there's nowhere for the water to go. There are two reservoirs west of town, Addicks and Barker, and those are both rated 1, which is the lowest rating by the Corps of Engineers. In both cases, they were ready to break, and they had to do controlled releases and deliberately flood neighborhoods in order to avoid them breaking, which would have been utterly cataclysmic. When these things happen, you hear a lot of, you know, kind of hand-wringing and, you know, people, you know, alarm, but nothing gets done. And in fact, the regulations, it becomes even easier to build, and you see more construction and strip malls, you know, big apartment buildings and townhouses and things like that going up. So if you look at the data, if you look at the topography, we actually have a lot less, you know, green now than we did, even though these storms get incrementally worse. It's a recipe for greater disaster, obviously.
I've read that the city of Houston, the fourth largest city in America, has no zoning regulations, that there is just unchecked development as far as the eye can see, with no restrictions, you know, for floodplains and other mm-hmm. critical infrastructure that most cities take into account when allowing buildings to go up in certain parts, vulnerable parts
yeah,
of the city.
I mean, it's true. Usually when you read these, you take them with a grain of salt, but it's true. There's no zoning. There's really no regulation. No one's unaware of the problem here, and there's an outcry about it in the immediate aftermath of these, and then they just kind of get stopped. I call it cowboy capitalism here in Texas. You know, the government's bad. We don't want people telling us what to do. We don't want regulations. It's going to cost us jobs. You know, Texas has touted itself as different and kind of an economic miracle. And, you know, a lot of times when the rest of the country is suffering really bad economic downturns, they're less severe here. But that kind of becomes the excuse to do nothing because things are going well. And if we start caving into tree huggers, we're going to lose jobs and the economy's not going to be as good. And so nothing in inertia sets in. And nothing gets done. And, you know, it's like the old joke, right? You know, if you got a hole in your roof, you know, when it's raining, you can't fix it. And when it's dry, it's as good as anybody's roof. So that's kind of the way they look at things.
Wow. There are these 8 trailers of organic peroxides that we've all been reading mm-hmm. about that have caught on fire. And
right.
extremely noxious and toxic smoke is going far and wide around the town of Crosby there. Then Lieutenant Governor Abbott, who's now serving as the Texas governor, had put in place some regulations that allowed chemical companies like Arkema to keep secret what
yes.
they have in their
exactly.
chemical plants. And my question is, you've got a lot of people living in this region who are, they themselves or their children are being exposed to this, yet the government and these corporations are conspiring with each other to keep it secret and not allowing some kind of transparency so people can protect themselves. It seems another case where self-interest is being trumped by corporate interests.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know what to say. Even the first responders, you know, when they first got there, they didn't know what to expect. So about 21, I think, in the first wave, we ended up in the emergency ward of the local hospital. They're unaware of what's going on. I mean, you know, I don't know who owns it, but I'm pretty sure it's a French company, so the owners probably are in Paris. But, you know, even the local managers probably don't live next to the plant. And it's just not in their interest. I mean, I think if all of these 500 facilities told everybody in the neighborhoods where they're located what was there, I mean, I think a lot more people would be a lot more concerned. And, you know, but the governor, as you said, after the explosion of West Texas actually, you know, made it easier for them to withhold this information. And, you know, once you toxic chemicals are emitted into water, you know, they can go anywhere. They're not confined. But, you know, we always say, you know, well, this is the one that's going to force people to act. And, you know, let's hope it does. But if you lived in Texas, I've been there for over 20 years now. I've heard that many times. I heard it after Allison in 2001. Well, we're going to have to do something now. And, you know, actually what they did was pave up even more land, you know, in the interest of these corporations, especially the petroleum and the chemical industries, which are, you know, I mean, this is one of the most industrialized cities in the world and really the kind of the world capital for what they call energy. You would think in their own self-interest, right, to maintain their own stability, they would do something. Maybe this time they will. But we've heard this before, you know, those of us who've lived there.
That was Robert Bazanko, professor of history at the University of Houston. Find more analysis and commentary on how Houston's unchecked development and lax regulations exacerbated the destruction wrought by Hurricane Harvey by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Storms over Texas. Hurricane Harvey has struck the Gulf region of Texas, and it has hit with an awe and power that can scarcely be believed. Houston, which took the title to the fourth largest city in America from Philadelphia years ago, now has a new title, Most Flooded U.S. City in U.S. History. Harvey became a tropical storm, spun back into the Gulf, and returned with a vengeance, spilling over 50 inches of rain in hours, sending most of the city into floods that Americans haven't seen since Katrina in New Orleans. It arrives just in time to remind people what global warming means, even as its idiotic misleader claims climate change is a hoax. President Trump, called by some insane clown president, once called climate change just that, as he arrives for a photo op. Is it a hoax now? Thousands of people are watching their lives wash away with higher and higher floodwaters. Politicians, whores of their corporate funders, are smiling as they bank their donations, while mothers and grandmothers and children drown in their attics and in flood-swollen streets in America's fourth largest city. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Previously, the recent events of Charlottesville, Virginia, were turning points in American history. But what is its source? Its source is the source of American identity. For what makes America, America, is not what it is, but what it is not. An African historian once told me that American identity was formed negatively. He explained that America was formed by populations that defined itself as white. What did white mean? It meant non-black, non-Indian, non-Asian, and non-Latinos. That was its beginnings. That is its present. Donald Trump ran on fear, white fear. Fear of blacks, foreigners, everybody else. And Charlottesville, Virginia is a reflection, too, of that white fear. America is a land awash in fear. Fear of the future. Fear of a black and brown planet. Fear of the passing away of white America. Fear of the America to come. That fear made Trump president. That fear lies beneath everything. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Progress have activists made in exposing the truth behind the September 11th attacks? Who is Leroy Hulsey, and what is unprecedented about his team's report on the collapse of World Trade Center 7? Is there a way of taking the 9/11 truth movement beyond education and awareness making to the halls of power, and what are the prospects for meaningful political change? What were the true motives behind America's 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, and what are the motives behind the recent escalation of that war effort? Why is it still relevant to expose the fraudulent nature of the war on terrorism 16 years after those devastating attacks? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on the occasion of the anniversary of 9/11, we take a look at the movement seeking to expose the lies around the World Trade Center attacks, which supposedly triggered it, as well as the prospects that the 9/11 Truth Movement can make a difference in world affairs. Our guests for the hour are Richard Gage, AIA, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and Michelle Chosadovsky, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. On this week's program, does 9/11 still matter? Conversations with Richard Gage and Michelle Chosadovsky. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 8th, 2017. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. According to the figures, UK armed air missions in Syria rose by 480% in the first half of 2017 compared with the previous 6 months. However, rather surprisingly, in the light of the huge increase in missions in Syria, the vast majority of UK airstrikes continues to occur in Iraq, with 81% of UK missile and bombs dropped there in the first half of the year. Responses to our queries about this appear to indicate that this is due to UK aircraft deployed on missions inside Syria not launching their weapons there, but in Iraq on their return journey. UK weapons fired in Syria did increase by almost 50% from 79 in last 6 months of 2016 to 118 in first half of 2017. Figures show that the focus of UK Reaper drone operations also switched from Iraq to Syria in the first 6 months of 2017. That comes from the article, British Air and Drone Strikes in Iraq and Syria, UK Reaper Drone Ops, by Chris Cole, posted September 7th, originally appearing at Drone Wars UK. Far from saving lives in Syria, flying around between the US and Europe and collecting awards seems to be all that this group is doing. Last October, the White Helmets were also tipped to receive the Nobel Peace Prize, but apparently committee members backtracked at the last minute, instead giving the award to Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos. It wasn't long after that when the group scooped up an Oscar award for their Netflix documentary film. As one writer put it, quote, "Perhaps the only reason this group deserved to win an Oscar was for their acting skills, not their humanitarian efforts," unquote. This latest award should be seen for what it is, another ritual ceremony by the establishment to bolster the reputation of a failed construct, a carefully manufactured pseudo-search and rescue NGO with very visible links to extremists, terrorist organizations, and under the umbrella of covert Western intelligence operations to destabilize the nation of Syria. That comes from the article, Tipperary's White Helmets Peace Prize, a Judas Kiss to the Anti-War Movement in Syria, by Patrick Henningsen, posted September 7th, originally appearing at 21st Century Wire. A new USA Today investigation reveals that top executives, lobbyists, and contractors are buying access to President Donald Trump through memberships at the president's numerous golf clubs, adding further concerns about the administration's ethical conflicts. Reacting to the story, one observer wrote on Twitter, quote, "In the developing world, this is called corruption," unquote. Membership lists of Trump's golf clubs are not publicly available, so USA Today tracked the names down through social media posts, news stories, and records on the U.S. Golf Association website, which show players' handicaps and scores. With those records, the news outlet found 4,500 names. That comes from the article, Golfing with Trump. Analysis reveals powerful elite can literally play for access, by Andrea Romanos. Posted September 7th, originally appearing at Common Dreams. Both the China-Russia economic cooperation and trade agreements, as well as their currencies being covered by gold, is part of a larger, already fairly advanced scheme of de-dollarization of their economies. In other words, Russia and China, as well as the entire Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, are rapidly moving out of the U.S. dollar hegemony. Let's face it, the entire Western monetary system is basically a fraud. It is privately made and privately owned, with the entire international payment system being controlled by the Fed, which is totally privately owned, and the BIS, Bank for International Settlement in Basel, Switzerland, also called the Central Bank of Central Banks. All international transfers and payments have to transit through Wall Street banks. That was from the transcript of an interview with Peter Koenig for Sputnik under the headline, "Gold Trade Between Russia and China, a Step Closer Towards De-Dollarization," posted September 7th. Hezbollah swiftly defeated Daesh in an effective anti-terrorist campaign coordinated with the Syrian Arab Army along the mountainous Syrian-Lebanese border. Observers were taken aback by how quickly victory was attained, as the terrorist group has hitherto put up fierce resistance elsewhere in the country. This testifies to the growing strength of Hezbollah as one of the world's most effective anti-terrorist on-the-ground forces, as well as the relative weakening of Daesh as it approaches its dying days. Hezbollah's major victory against Daesh also sent strong signals to the three-headed Cerberus of Israel, the U.S., and Saudi Arabia, that the group is very capable of defending itself against all threats, and that its battle-hardened skills in Syria can also be used to defend their Lebanese homeland if it ever came under threat, once again by those three allied actors. Consequently, this means that their subversive plans against the resistance arc will have to be modified, since the strategy of expanding Daesh into Lebanon has clearly failed. That comes from the article, unending war in Syria? Hezbollah won, but Israel won't stop supporting ISIS-Daesh. By Andrew Korybko, posted September 7th, originally appearing at Oriental Review. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. This week marks the 16th anniversary of one of the most significant single events in world history, namely the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Scores of researchers have come forward in the intervening years and presented their evidence challenging the official story that Osama bin Laden and his band of co-conspirators managed to bamboozle the $40 billion a year intelligence apparatus of the United States and launch attacks that brought down three skyscrapers in New York City using two airplanes. These critiques have been around for as long as there has been a war on terrorism. However, just recently, a professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks presented on a draft report from a team he is heading. This report promises to be groundbreaking and looks exclusively at the collapse of the third tower, World Trade Center 7. The report promises to discredit the authoritative analysis from the National Institute for Standards and Technology, or NIST. Here is an excerpt of what he had to say during his September 6th presentation.
Also in the NIST documentation, page 525, 2008, a girder was considered to have lost vertical support when its web was no longer supported by the bearing seat. That means the girder. That means if they're lost of bearing support on A2001 coming into the column 79, then it's lost. The bearing seat at column 79 was 11 inches wide. Thus, when the girder end at column 79 had been pushed laterally at least 5.5 inches, the web over, it was no longer supported by that bearing seat. NIST changed that 5.5 inches to 6.25 inches when it was shown that the seat was actually 12 inches wide. So that's kind of something to think about. Why did that happen? And that was later.
Well, to tell us more about the presentation of Leroy Hulsey and some of the upcoming activities surrounding 9/11 truth and justice, we are joined once again by past guest Richard Gage. Richard Gage, AIA, is a San Francisco Bay Area architect and member of the American Institute of Architects. He's the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. AE911truth.org has the names of close to 3,000 now architects and engineers demanding a new investigation into the destruction of all three World Trade Center high-rise buildings on 9/11. Richard Gage, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be here.
So first of all, I know that you've been involved with this research for more than a decade now, as I just indicated, and I know that you have already presented quite a lot of very compelling analysis that destroys or at least significantly challenges the official explanations that have been offered by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, NIST, and other the 9/11 Commission and other bodies. I'm wondering, though, what makes Professor Leroy Hulsey's presentation distinct, unique? Why is this something that people who have been following your work for years, what is important about it that we really need to highlight it?
Well, he's doing a finite element analysis, and he's almost through with it. It's a two-year, $300,000 study. This is a very serious effort, one of the main flagship projects of the University of Alaska. And he's the chair of the Civil Engineering Department, one of the top forensic structural engineers in the country. And he looked at Building 7 coming down, and he was really curious about how that building could have fallen, according to NIST, by normal office fires. So here's a 47-story skyscraper that collapses in the afternoon of 9/11. Wasn't hit by an airplane. But after witnesses hear explosions, this building drops like a rock straight down uniformly, symmetrically, into its own footprint at free fall acceleration in under 7 seconds in the exact manner of a classic controlled demolition. So the effort to by NIST to explain this as a result of office fires is ludicrous. And every architect and engineer who finds out about this building, and by the way, most of them do not even know, because their associations like the American Institute of Architects, American Society of Civil Engineers, have not broadcast this building at all, even though it's the third worst structural failure in modern history. So Professor Halsey's effort at this scale in academia will take the academic and professional communities of engineers by storm. It'll turn it upside down, first making them aware that there was a skyscraper that allegedly fell by fire, and second, showing that it could not have fallen due to normal office fires. Every column, Professor Halsey said in last night in his live-streamed progress report, he said that every column would have to have been severed at once. And so when asked how could that have happened, he says, I'll leave that up to your imagination.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that forward, because I was actually very impressed by the professionalism, the technical details, and the dignity with which he presented this. It's hard for even a hater to look at that presentation and say, oh, this guy's a conspiracy lunatic, right? So, and he didn't use the words controlled demolition. He didn't talk about explosives. And for that matter, he didn't mention the collapse of the two twin towers. So, but was there anything about that presentation or what he has on the docket? Is this just a question of bringing real professional expertise to this question, or was there something in there that was novel or unique or that people didn't know about before?
Well, most people don't even know the building fell down. First of all, including most students across the country in engineering schools and professionals as well. So the whole thing was new to them, most of them. In addition to that, he went into great detail to show how at every step NIST had produced either fraudulent, consciously or incompetent reports that all of their assumptions. Or most of them are not even to be believed. For instance, they said that there was no shear studs tying the floor slab to the girder. That was in question, that the long span beams through a new phenomena in fire destruction of buildings caused the thermal expansion of these 50-foot-long beams, pushing a girder off of its seat on this column, causing an internal progressive collapse, and then the vertical instability all the way up to the top, and then that travels laterally through the building. So he showed that none of that really could have happened, even if you assume NIST's faulty input data. So in the worst case, this building could not have fallen due to fire, and that's revealed also in his computer simulation comparison of NIST's computer model to the actual videos, which their computer model bears no resemblance to the actual videos. If there was such a cascading collapse like they said, you would have had massive perimeter structural steel deformation and breaking up of granite panels and windows and crumpling it like a beer can. None of that happens in reality, indicating that something else happened, which could only have been a pre-placed explosive synchronistically timed floor by floor, because the building falls exactly like those old hotels in Las Vegas that we've all seen. And that's why we have in Washington, D.C., the press conference on September 11th, Monday at 1 p.m. At the National Press Club, a presentation, an announcement of the Bobby McElvain Act. Bobby was lost at the World Trade Center to explosions, okay, which are not a part of the official story.
So could you just tell us a little bit more about that Bobby McElvain Act?
Yeah, he's definitely one of the sponsoring family members of this act on behalf of his son and all family members who have not achieved justice or truth relative to the destruction of all three towers on 9/11. So this act requires Congress to begin an investigation of the destruction with the explosive evidence, the incendiary evidence of the Twin Towers and the Building 7, where even FEMA documented very carefully the hot sulfur corrosion attack, an attack of molten iron on the steel, the ends of the beams being evaporated, according to the author, Jonathan Barnett, a fire protection engineer. So this act incorporates this evidence, and we will take the act following this press conference to every member of Congress, 535 of them, and we have already have appointments with more than a dozen of them, Congress members and staffers. This is a very important effort in the 9/11 Truth Movement to bring about a real investigation, and we're looking for the conditions of support for a congressperson who will step out and take the heat, as we have in the 9/11 Truth Movement, for truth and for justice, and we can stop these needless wars and this $4.5 trillion war, global war on terrorism, which all goes back to the fraud of 9/11, because the evidence shows that the Twin Towers also were brought down by explosive demolition, as evidenced in the videos where we have explosive isolated ejections at 200 feet per second below the point of jet plane impacts, with freely flying structural steel sections ejected laterally out of the Twin Towers at 60 to 80 miles an hour, landing 600 feet in every direction, with a complete pulverization of 90,000 tons of concrete in midair. Not that they're stacked up at the bottom in any fashion. There's no photos or videos that show that.
And so there's certainly on your like the, on your website, for example, I think highlights a lot of these technical details that might change people's minds about that the official story. But just to drill down a little bit on the Bobby McElvain Act and you know what you're demanding a new investigation. But I'm wondering though, I mean. For those of our listeners who get what you're talking, who visit your site and support your work, I can imagine that many of them would be skeptical of the success of this venture. And I'll tell you why. Just sort of a friendly argument, if I might. This idea that going to these politicians and asking them to present this and move it forward, because it seems to me that, you know, the implication of your work. I mean, you don't come out and say it, but you do ask the question, who had the means, motive, and opportunity to orchestrate these attacks? You know, who would have planted the explosion? So clearly there had to have been high-level state and military involvement. So I'm wondering, though, I mean, given that there's so much literally invested in the 9/11 narrative and this war on terrorism, I'm wondering – is it realistic to believe that Congress at the end of the day would vote in this act and deliver an authentic investigation as opposed to the kind of cover-up commission that we already saw? What do you say to that kind of skepticism?
It's a very fair skeptical question, because so far, 16 years later, we haven't found but one or two congresspersons who are not even in office at this time due to their outspoken nature. I'm referring to Cynthia McKinney, Ron Paul, others. Rand Paul may be helpful, and there may be a few others that are helpful. But we're not asking Congress to investigate. First of all, we're requiring them to investigate it. It is a posture of, here is the evidence. You're now held accountable, Congress, for the third time, because we brought this evidence to them when we had 1,000 architects and engineers, 2,000. Now we have nearly 3,000, and we have to hold Congress accountable. It's a law. It's a universal law. You can't just ignore the Constitution and the and the opportunities that have been given to us and fought for by our forefathers to bring this evidence to bear. We have to do what we can. And then, yes, maybe we don't have the level of trust right now, and maybe they don't have the level of support, those who are open-minded about it. But that will come. It is inevitable. There is a rise of patriotism in this country, a rise of the various truth movements who are due primarily to the opportunities given to us by the Internet, are communicating with each other and educating others. So there will come a time when we can have enough people in Congress to make a difference when the American people wake up. And I think that process has begun, and I'm very hopeful about it. It's not it is not hopeless. It may not happen today. It may not happen next week or next year, but it will happen. And this is a process which is essential toward that end.
Richard, what other initiatives are you pursuing in order to achieve justice? I mean, I like going beyond the Bobby McElvain Act, maybe months, years down the line, is there a larger game plan that you guys are pursuing, other strategies?
Our strategy is to primarily to educate the American people, get into the mainstream media whenever we can. We have plenty of alternative media. Well, not even enough of that exposure. But we've done 600 radio interviews. We've presented to over 550 audiences in 43 countries around the world. And we're not the only ones at AE 911 Truth. This is happening around the globe. It is it's like a swimming pool that you're filling in terms of metrics. You can't tell readily that we're, you know, over the ridge and ready to launch. But we've been building the awareness in the public unconscious that when it reaches a critical mass, we'll spring forward. So our strategies are primarily to not only educate the public, but the professionals as well. And that's where the Leroy Halsey study comes in. We expect that to be like wildfire in the engineering schools and communities. And we have a massive effort as a strategy to make them aware of it to the extent that they're not aware. And they may well listen to one of their own top forensic structural engineers, the chairperson of the civil engineering department at a major university. So, yes, that's our main strategy right now. But it's on all fronts, public, media, and academic and professional communities, as well as government.
Hmm. And maybe just one last thought. I mean, in terms of, you mentioned that the $4.5 trillion war and so on. I'm just wondering to what extent these warmongers even need 9/11 anymore, because, I mean, we're still seeing a lot of military belligerence towards North Korea and all of these, the so-called terrorist attacks in Western Europe. I mean, is it possible that the war on terrorism has just taken on a life of its own and that we don't really need the 9/11 narrative to continue? Or is it would that breakthrough that you talk about really lead to a complete change in all aspects of foreign policy?
Well, I certainly believe, in those in the 9/11 Truth movement along with me, that the 9/11 Truth is a 2x4 over the head. Once people really get it, and a lot more people in the overall truth communities need to get it, it will knock over the rest of the dominoes, because when we realize we've been lied to at this scale, you know, not just that Iraq, we were lied to. Most people already agree with that lie. I mean, they know that we've been lied to about the reasons for going into Iraq, and they kind of just absorb it, but they can't still imagine that we've been lied to about the worst crime of the century and that it's been effectively covered up by the mainstream media for 80% of the public. So we certainly believe that that this issue, which spawned a $4.5 trillion global war on terror, the killing of 2 million people in Afghanistan and Iraq, the invasion of four or five other countries, and the loss of our civil liberties through the Patriot Act, the Military Commission Act, all of that goes back to 9/11. So you pull the thread out from that lie, and the whole rug begins to come apart. So that's why I think it's extremely important we all focus on the truth about 9/11. Beating people over the head, well, that hasn't been particularly effective, but, you know, just telling the truth out there, particularly with the credible evidence of 2,900 architects and engineers and our film, 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out, which just pulls 40 high-rise architects, structural engineers, metallurgists, chemists, physicists, controlled demolition experts, all laying out this evidence for the explosive destruction of all three towers. I think major things will happen all across the spectrum of these other false flag events and other conspiracies, if you will, aren't getting enough attention either.
Okay. Richard Gage, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Michael.
We've been speaking with Richard Gage, AIA. He's a San Francisco Bay Area architect and member of the American Institute of Architects. He's the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And for more details about their work and research, you can visit the website ae911truth.org. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. I'm very privileged to have with us Professor Michelle Chosadovsky. He's an award-winning author, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Ottawa, and he's the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order from 2003, America's War on Terrorism from 2005, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity from 2015. Professor Chosadovsky, I think a lot of people might argue it's hard to argue why it's relevant to continue looking at 9/11 truth and its consequences. Is that something? Why do you think we still have to continue to reveal and disclose the truth behind 9/11?
Well, I think 9/11 truth is fundamental because without 9/11 lies, so to speak, the global war on terrorism falls flat, okay? Because 9/11, in a sense, redefined U.S. military doctrine. It was in the wake of 9/11 that they launched the global war on terrorism. And the global war on terrorism has been the backbone of justifying military intervention in a large number of countries. While at the same time supporting the terrorists in Iraq and Syria and so on. So I think it is fundamental. And I think the geopolitics behind the 9/11 events are so important because right at the outset, on the morning of 9/11, in fact, it was at 11 o'clock in the morning, the Bush administration had already announced that al-Qaeda was responsible for the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But in fact, that assertion also implied that Afghanistan, so to speak, had attacked America, because the following day, the Atlantic Council, the governing body of NATO, actually invoked the fact that a member state of the Atlantic Alliance had been attacked, and under the doctrine of collective security, all members of NATO would then stand in solidarity with the United States, and it was on that basis that they declared war on Afghanistan. Now, visibly, there were no Afghani jet fighters in the skies of New York that morning. And whatever the nature, whoever was responsible for the 9/11 attacks, it was really fiction to say that Afghanistan had attacked America. And then we recall that a few weeks later, on October 7th, October 7th, the United States and its NATO allies waged war on Afghanistan, a war retribution under the doctrine of collective security. And that was total fabrication. And it justified waging a war on a sovereign country some thousands of miles away in Central Asia on the grounds that they were harboring bin Laden. Now, that was a lie, because, first of all, bin Laden on the 10th of September was in a Pakistani military hospital. How do we know that? Dan Rather, CBS News. He reported on that subsequently. He was, his whereabouts were known. And then he did actually return to Afghanistan, and the Afghani government, the so-called Taliban, through diplomatic channels, advised their counterparts in Washington to say, if there's ample proof that bin Laden is behind these terrorist attacks, we will deliver bin Laden to the U.S. justice system. And that was done twice in the course of the month of September. And Bush responded by saying, we do not negotiate with terrorists. And so they dispelled the idea that Afghanistan would hand over bin Laden to the U.S. Judicial system. They proceeded with war preparations, launching a major theater war 4 weeks later on the 7th of October. And virtually every single military analyst knows that you cannot prepare a large-scale theater war several thousands of miles away in a matter of 4 weeks.
So the war was prepared before September 11th, obviously.
That war was prepared well in advance of September 11th.
So what was the actual aim of that war, if not to fight terrorists?
The aim of that war was conquest. Afghanistan is a geopolitical hub. First of all, it has tremendous resources, mineral resources. There's oil. There are pipelines. It's the gateway to Central Asia historically, and of course, Afghanistan also produced more than 90% of the world's supply of heroin, which is a multi-billion-dollar operation in its own right. And it's worth noting. I don't think that this was necessarily the only objective of that war, but the Taliban, with the support of the United Nations, implemented a drug eradication program, crop substitution, which led to a 90% fall in opium production in the year 2001. And immediately following the invasion, the levels of opium production gradually regained the historical levels, and they have increased something like 30 times since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October 2001.
Sorry, Professor Chossudovsky, I don't want to belabor the issue too much, but I think maybe our listeners need an understanding, and I know that that's probably a whole separate discussion, but what possible incentive would NATO countries have in allowing opium production to increase? Can you address that quickly?
Well, you know, opium is the drug trade is a multi-billion dollar operation worldwide. It reaps tremendous amount of profit to not only to criminal syndicates but to the financial apparatus, to banking, where the narco dollars are deposited, and this is well understood and has been analyzed by many prominent scholars. supporting a geopolitical agenda which endorses the drug trade is something which is well understood. We also have it in South America. Okay? But I'm not suggesting that was the casus belli. You have to look at the history of Afghanistan, and that war didn't start in 2001. It started in 1997. Okay, it goes back to the Reagan administration.
Right, Operation Cyclone, I think.
Yeah, it goes back to the so-called Soviet Afghan War. That was a war in which the United States was heavily involved. So, and now we see the resurgence of that war with the Trump administration sending in troops, and the fact of the matter is that whole area of Central Asia is militarized. The objective is to establish military bases. The objective is to gain control over strategic raw materials, including lithium, which is it's the input into producing batteries. It has an impact on the energy market. There's natural gas. There's oil, it is also that area which it's at, you know, we have to understand that Afghanistan is a border with China. Okay, it's very close to the former republics of the Soviet Union. It really is a geopolitical pivot, and Chinese interests are heavily involved in Afghanistan as part of the so-called the Belt and Road Initiative. So we're talking about conquest, occupation and conquest, because that is what has characterized all these wars since 2001, and of course before 2001. Mm-hmm. Libya, an oil economy, one of the largest or the second largest in Africa. Yemen, of course, very, very strategic. Syria, Iraq. These are the wars in which the United States is involved, and various other parts of the world. The menace against Venezuela, which is now has the largest oil reserves in the world. Admittedly, a large part of those are tar sands, but nonetheless, it is considered strategic. And underlying, to get back to 9/11, underlying the various wars in the Middle East is always the pretext of going after bin Laden or going after the terrorists. And the whole structure of U.S. military doctrine is the global war on terrorism. So that 9/11 truth is, to get back to 9/11, 9/11 truth is fundamental. The official story is that the United States has been attacked by a foreign power or by terrorists. It's the same doctrine which has characterized the various attacks in Western European countries, including Barcelona, Manchester, and Brussels, that Western society is being threatened by an outside enemy, and that outside enemy is also the architect of the 9/11 attacks. Of course, all of this is fiction, but nonetheless, the media will uphold it and will deny the truth. That not only are the terrorists an instrument of conquest, they are the foot soldiers, but the whole idea of going after the terrorists is this total fabrication. The objective is not to go after the terrorists. The objective is to undermine sovereign countries, destroy them, transform them into territories, and take over their resources.
I'm wondering if 16 years later we've kind of moved beyond 9/11. I mean, do we even need 9/11, you know, to be scared of this recent upsurgence in Islamic extremists in places like Barcelona and Manchester and so forth? Because I mean, I think one could conceivably argue that yes, 9/11 was, you know, an inside job, that yes, that it was a fraudulent war on terrorism, but now we've got a kind of Frankenstein's monster in ISIS that, you know, that it's like an unintended consequences or blowback. So if it is possible to believe that 9/11, that 9/11's narrative is phony and still support more war because we've got these unintended consequences, I wonder if 9/11 truth is able to retain its significance. I mean, talking about the collapse of the Twin Towers and you know, all those other things. Could you address that?
But the logic of 9/11, or should I say the logic of the attacks in Brussels, Barcelona, etc., are very similar to the 9/11 attacks. Then they're false flags. I can say that with, you know, I can say that because the governments of those countries are supportive of ISIS, and ISIS is an al-Qaeda-linked organization in terms of its history. And when the Spanish government says, or the Spanish media say that ISIS is behind the attacks because the U.S.-led coalition has driven them out of Syria and Iraq. Hello, it's not these countries that have driven them out. It's the Syrians, the Iraqi resistance, and the support of Russia and Iran. Now, Russia has not been targeted by ISIS. Now, ISIS is supported by, we know that ISIS is covertly supported by the U.S. alliance. It's documented. We have official documents which prove it. So that it doesn't make sense for the Spanish government to say, or even for the media to say, well, the ISIS is striking back on us, retribution for what we did to them in Syria. We didn't do anything to them in Syria. We protected them. Okay? So the whole discourse is upside down. Inasmuch as al-Qaeda is known to be an intelligence asset of the CIA, and that's well documented, the narrative simply does not hold, neither the 9/11 narrative nor the narrative regarding these various attacks in Western European cities. It doesn't make sense. We know that those terrorist organizations are linked to U.S. intelligence. They're on the radar of law enforcement and intelligence in Western Europe. It's proven and documented practically in each of these attacks. Mm-hmm. So that these are false flags. Okay, they can be. The media is lying to us, and to say that where, of course, 9/11 comes in, is that each of these attacks is presented as an attack by an outside enemy, which is in Raqqa, Syria, or wherever, in Mosul. They're attacking us. We must then attack back. We justified that. We use these attacks to justify a military intervention on humanitarian grounds in the Middle East. We justify it in view of waging a campaign of Islamophobia within Western European countries, which at the same time weakens any kind of anti-war movement. We haven't had an anti-war movement in the West since 2003. And why? Because the anti-war collectors will say, we're against the war, but we support the war on terrorism. But they don't dare to say that the war on terrorism is fake. Okay? The war on terrorism is fake. It can't be anything else because the terrorists are instruments of Western intelligence, not to mention Israel, which also supports the ISIS, al-Nusra, and the various al-Qaeda-affiliated entities.
Yeah, I know that your own research, this is what you've pioneered and others, but you've basically provided a bit of a bridge insofar as you maintain that the U.S. and other Western intelligence agencies have been supporting these Islamic extremists all along. And so you have a link there between, you know, the 9/11 attacks and these what's been, you know, we're seeing with the ISIS and these recent attacks in Europe. But I'm wondering if you have any reservations about aspects of the 9/11 truth that maybe don't pursue that approach. Like I say, you know, we had a recent right now there's an initiative afoot called the Bobby McIlvaine World Trade Center Investigation Act, in which you have activists trying to get a new investigation into 9/11, and it seems to mostly be revolved not so much on the geopolitics but on the mechanics of the destruction of the buildings. I wonder if you might wish to offer up an opinion as to that kind of approach of engaging these politicians to bring about a new investigation and where that's likely to head. Will it result in the kind of dismembering of a consensus that you seem to be focused on?
Well, I don't think we should ask the protagonists of the global war on terror to wage an investigation, okay? We have enough material to refute the official narrative, and what we need is a criminal investigation to start with, a criminal investigation to who brought down the towers. Now, look at tower number 7. It wasn't hit by an aircraft. It had a little bit of fire, and then, of course, the bringing down of that tower was announced 20 to 30 minutes before it actually occurred. There is a conspiracy there. How is it that CNN and the BBC knew that the tower was going to come down and reported on it while it was still there?
Well, I mean, the way this is going to play out, I mean, you know as well as I do that mainstream media, the bulk of mainstream media is owned, like I say, 90-95% are owned by 6 mega corporations, which are all literally invested in the 9/11 narrative and this war agenda. So it seems nonsensical to think that you're going to get any progress there. And I think likewise, the political system, any politician who speaks out is likely going to be facing a lot of challenges. So I'm wondering what apparatuses are at the disposal to get real justice, to get Dick Cheney and other conspirators thrown in jail. Is that a realistic outcome? I mean, people taking to the streets, which is what we're seeing right now, but
it's not going to be. It's not going to happen when the protest movement is financed by Wall Street, and I think that's one aspect.
Well, how do we get? How do we get past that?
We have to start rebuilding mass movements. The anti-war movement in Canada, the United States, and Western Europe is dead, and it's dead precisely because, A, it's probably infiltrated, it's financed, and then people, you know, don't want to go against this consensus. They said the consensus is that our countries are being attacked by terrorists. They don't want to go against that, okay? And they say, no, yes, we support the war on terrorism. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there's been no real protest movement against the wars that there's been no protest movement against the war in Syria, okay? And I know I belong to the collective here in Montreal, and the consensus is virtually to say no. This is a civil war. It's not a civil war, and when it's a civil war, you don't have an anti-war movement. And so we have to break it's a narrative, it's a lie, but people believe in the lie, or they feel they have to believe in the lie because the lie is a consensus.
I wanted to, sorry, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to bring up one more point, and this has to do with, I mean, even if we should be successful in dismantling that consensus around the war on terrorism, what I'm looking at these days is saber-rattling at North Korea and China and Russia, which are not easily, you know, synchronized with a fear of Islamic extremists. So, I mean, even if we do smash that consensus, what about this idea that Russia that invaded Crimea and they interfered in the U.S. elections? I mean, I don't see 9/11 truth really dismantling and that idea. You know, that
well,
idea. So how is there any?
Fundamentally, we're dealing with media, with a media propaganda. We're dealing with a propaganda apparatus which is very overwhelming and sophisticated. I mean, I've been following the situation in Korea. People don't know that 30% of the North Korean population was killed during the Korean War. Okay,
genocidal.
That is unprecedented in world history. And then they say, oh, they are a threat to our security. Well, we happen to have killed about 30% of their population.
So that basically that speaks to the idea of getting people to understand that the media, the mainstream media, is not their friend. And I think one thing that does seem to have changed since 2001 is a lot less confidence in mainstream media, and a growth of independent media, including your site, Global Research. So I just wondering if you had any parting comments about your site and its role in maybe some of the challenges that need to be overcome and how maybe our listeners can help.
Well, I mean, I think people are asking questions, but they're not really involved in any meaningful protest against U.S. imperialism, which is supported by media lies and fabrications. And of course, in more recent events, there's attempt to, in a sense, to undermine the online independent and alternative media through the manipulation of search engines and so on. That's another debate, but it's very, very significant. But what we have to start doing is to build a mass movement, which is grassroots, which is not supported by those who sponsor these wars and sponsor the terrorists, and the truth is fundamental. And once the lies becomes the truth, so to speak, because that's really what's happening, there's no moving backwards. We have to confront systematically the instruments of war propaganda, okay, which are distorting our understanding of what's happening. And then people might start rebuilding. But that's not an easy process. It's not an easy process. But 9/11 truth is still part of it. It's, as you mentioned, it's not the only thing, because there are other lies and fabrications. And there are other wars. There's Venezuela. There's South Sudan. There's Yemen. I think what we have to start looking into is a movement which confronts the U.S. imperial agenda, which is destructive in nature and which could potentially lead us into a World War III scenario.
Well, Professor Chostovsky, I wish we had more time, but we've just about run out now. So I want to thank you very much for your insights on this anniversary, and I hope we can have more conversations over the course of the next year.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Professor Michel Chossudovsky. He's the director of the Center for Research on Globalization, founder of the site globalresearch.ca, and which is, as of September 9th, celebrating its 16th anniversary.
For more analysis of 9/11 and the war on terrorism, be sure to visit globalresearch.ca. Click the iBooks series tab and then find the dossier under the heading 9/11 Reader. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.